It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is here. Stacey Higginbotham's here. Matthew Ingram is. Congratulations to Matthew. He's winning a major journalism award this week. We will talk about McLuhan because it's an award from the McLuhan folks. We'll also talk about the president. He's mad as heck about Twitter, and he's not going to take it anymore. And what they're doing in Toronto with Sidewalk. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 514, recorded Wednesday, June 26th, 2019. Alphabetical. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest from the Googleverse, Facebook, Twitter, yeah, a little bit of Google, too. Jeff Jarvis is in Toronto today.
Oh, Canada.
You know, I don't want to admit this. Well, so Jeff's here, professor at the blah, 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 at this, you know, blah, blah, Satellite Center. Craig Newmark, official chair of the thing at the CUNY Graduate School of Talmark, Nightmark, Journalism. And then, I'm sorry, Jeff. I don't have it. If I can't read it. Buzz Machine. If people watch the show don't know who you are, forget it. Also with us, of course, Stacey Higginbotham and her new digs in the Pacific Northwest. Hello, Stacey.
She unpacked her microphone.
Look at that.
I did. I put up my little sound panels. I've got one more thing coming and then I'm done.
This is your studio now.
Yep.
Nice. It looks great.
Is that a brother or an HP behind you?
It's a brother. Oh, rats. Better be an Epson. Hey, is your reformer in there, your Pilates machine?
No, this is a very tiny office. Oh. So it's downstairs in our gym where we have an elliptical, the reformer, and a weight bench.
Boy, you really have embraced the Washington lifestyle. Washington State. And joining us also from Canada, because he and Jeff are at the same conference, the great Matthew Ingram from the Columbia Review.
Matthew lives here.
Yeah, well, you know, he didn't have to go very far, of course, chief digital writer at CJR.
And Matthew's also in a new home, I believe, yes?
Yeah, this is not it. I'm at the lake currently.
Oh, you're at the lake.
Matthew is at the lake.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You should have done the show on the kayak, Matthew. We're very disappointed.
I know.
The connectivity is not great.
In the summertime, Matthew's Instagram is taken over by feet in a kayak. Just
yes.
All lake, all the time. But Matthew, I do have to point out one little thing. I think it's probably the rise and fall of the Third Reich or something like that. But there is a swastika over your right shoulder. And I don't want to give people the wrong impression.
Hang on.
Yeah, just it's.
Right, oh yeah, there is.
Yeah,
where is it?
It does jump out at one, and I don't want.
I think that is the rise and fall.
Yeah, I recognize the spine because it's one of my favorite books.
Oh, there it is. Oh, I see it. Oh, that is it. Yes.
I just want to get this show banned in Germany or anything. So.
Cover your swastika. Is that what the request is?
Can you please cover the swastika?
Is that the show title?
Wait a minute. No, we can do it. We have the technology. Go ahead. I just have to tell you, there we go. We zoomed in, and now the lower third covers it all.
More of me, less swastika.
Actually, I don't know a lot of people with bookshelves in their houses with glass doors. That's very, very...
So this is actually my mom and dad's bookcase that they bought in Germany like the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it explains the swastika. It
weighs about 1,100 pounds.
Anyway.
How did they get it? Did they live there?
They did. Yeah.
Oh.
They did.
So they didn't just go there on vacation and bring back an 1,100 pound bookcase.
No, they lived in Germany for 4 or 5 years, I guess.
Oh, neat.
And lived in Holland for 4 or 5
years.
Oh,
that's neat.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Were you raised in those countries? Were you raised in the Low Countries?
I was born in Germany, but we only lived there for, I think, about a year or two. Yeah, my dad was in the
Deutsch.
So he was stationed there. No.
Nine. Nine is the word.
Nine.
So Matthew is going to be winning a major award on Friday. I'm sorry, I laughed. Let me do that again. Matthew is winning a major award on Friday. Very proud of you.
Oh, did we introduce him as an award-winning journalist yet?
Award-winning journalist. What is the award and what is it for?
It's called the James W. Carey Award for Outstanding Journalism, and it's from the Media Ecology Association.
Wow, that's pretty sweet.
And so Carey was a media theorist, and fascinating guy. I'm really glad to be winning this award because he's been a kind of not a hero, but a guy I've looked to sort of understand modern information. And Jeff, I think, is an admirer.
He's a hero of mine, and I've read his quotes on this show often. He's the one who talks about how society is a conversation. Media properly conceived is a conversation. Our role is the conversation, which is also McLuhan, who's the inspiration of the conference we're going to, Media Ecology. He understood conversation and orality.
Yeah. Carey talked about two sort of alternative views of information. One that journalists often think about is it's media just transmits information. So journalism tells people facts and they understand things, end of story. But the other way of looking at media is that it's about community. And so people don't necessarily look to or share information because it's factually true or accurate. It's because it makes them feel a certain way or because they want to belong to a certain group. And I think you see that a lot on social networks, for example.
Oh, yeah.
So this conference is about it's called a Media Ecology, the Media Ecology Conference. Is that the name of it? What is it?
So Media Ethics is the Media Ecology Association.
Okay.
And this conference is called Media Ethics, Human Ecology in a Connected World.
It's interesting because I'm just looking at Wikipedia's article on media ecology, and in place of the word media, you could easily use the word internet in this context. Media ecology, according to, I guess, Neil Postman, looks into the matter of how media of communication affect human perception, understanding, feeling, and value, and how our interaction with media facilitates or impedes our chances of survival. Boy, that couldn't be a hotter topic right now.
Mm-hmm. Amen, brother.
So Postman,
I've been geeking out of McLuhan. I saw the conference. I saw Matthew was speaking at the conference. I didn't even know about the award yet, and I asked him to introduce me to the organizer so I could. But I already bought the ticket immediately. I'm geeking out. It's a great conference.
Fun. Yeah, Postman, I guess, is the one who first coined that term, but it was based on McLuhan's work. So I asked. I asked a shameful question before the show. Is Marshall? Because Marshall McLuhan, when I was in high school. That was the medium is the message. In fact, there was a little book that all us high school kids read called The Medium is the Massage. That, I don't know what that meant, but I never did ever figure out what that meant. But it was about media. It was about this, how the media is the context, the petri dish we're growing in and our culture grows in. And it was very cool then in the 70s. And I just was wondering if it was still au courant today, if it was considered...
People think
a lot. Yeah. You know, I think about Alvin Toffler and Future Shock, which was also big in that time, and that hasn't aged all that well. How has Marshall McLuhan's philosophy?
I think it's gotten even more relevant. Like I think it's you know, at the time, and even well into the sort of 80s, I would say he seemed so out there. Like his views seemed to be so beyond what people were accustomed to thinking about. But as the internet and the digital age and disinformation and cyberspace and so on have become more and more a part of our lives, I think the way he thought about media and information and culture is just becoming more and more relevant. And I used this, or I referred to this quote when we were talking about it before, one that I think sums up the disinformation environment that we're living in right now. He said the Third World War was going to be a guerrilla information war with no division between military and civilian participation waged in cyberspace.
The Third World War will be an information guerrilla information war. Yeah.
No division between military and civilian participation.
Yeah.
Wait, guerrillas can't type.
But that's kind of what a guerrilla war implies, is that there aren't combatants and non-combatants, that everybody's a combatant.
Right, right. And he said that in 1970.
The other thing he said. Yeah. Go ahead, Matthew.
1970.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it.
But he didn't have any conception of cyberspace at the time. I mean, that didn't.
He did, actually.
Did he?
He did.
He had a sense of the electric age.
The electric. Right. So for him, it was TV, much as for Neil Postman. It was TV.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. But
he also talked about how, this I've talked about the Gutenberg parenthesis on the show, where how we cognate the world in an age of text, that when things are in packages and we think of the world in a linear fashion with a beginning and an end, and the line he said, this sentence is an example, becomes our organizing principle. So he really looked, he wasn't necessarily a fan or a hater of what he wrote about, but he tried to look at the impact it had on our lives and how it affected our worldview. That's the ecology.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about the internet, my friend Hussein Darakhshan has written about how, for him at least, the internet is becoming more and more like TV. So a lot of the things that Postman and McLuhan said about TV or saw in the future as TV grew have really come to pass, I think.
No, I think that's going to be temporary. I think it's an attempt at a reversion to form. But we'll see. I'm as I always say, I'm too old to know. And back to your Toffler point, Leo, the problem is, what McLuhan didn't predict the future. McLuhan understood transition. Future. I think futurist is the most ridiculous job title on earth. And Toffler tried to predict that future.
Right.
Well, he can't. By the way, medium as a massage. McLuhan's son, who died about a year and a half ago, said that McLuhan loved puns. Absolutely loved puns. His son argued that it was a typo that came back from the printer. That may have been a little too convenient, but he also liked the idea that it was the mess age.
Right. It's the mess age.
The way it hyphenated.
Yeah. It's good, because I never understood for a minute what that meant.
I didn't either. I kept on trying to. It was like watching 2001 A Space Odyssey. What does the obelisk mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was the era that we grew up in.
I never figured that out.
It was the era we grew up in. It was an era full of mysteries. And because it was a youth culture, and youth are basically clueless, it's just perfect. Perfect timing.
Well, plus, we think, when you're young, you think it's profound.
Say again?
Heavy, man. Plus, yeah, we're all heavy. On drugs.
We were all stoned. We didn't know. We thought it was cool.
McLuhan also talked about surveillance and how a sort of electric future would enable universal womb-to-tomb surveillance.
Well, it's a shame how long ago did he pass away? He would have been 108 today, I think. So,
well, look, okay, Google.
And
when was Marshall McLuhan born?
And now we mentioned Google for the first time on the show.
he was born
he died in
1911. So he missed all of this.
Yeah.
Well, except the early days of the internet.
Well, yeah.
Without trying to foresee it, he foresaw it.
So I'm going to bring up, as I often do on this show, one of my favorite. We've got to get her on the show, Zeynep Tufekci. I don't know how. It's a Turkish name, and of course we're inevitably.
Anyway, she's great.
Yeah, wonderful professor of sociology. Article this week on Wired: the internet has made dupes and cynics of us all. She has become the kind of Paul Revere of the internet era. But what she's talking about here, I thought maybe is kind of timely. Professor at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, is this notion of trust that in people that if we have been in the past in the United States a high trust society, low corruption, you could pretty much trust what people said. But that in the internet era, we become increasingly a low-trust society. Fake reviews on Amazon, Russian bots on Twitter, conversational AIs posing as humans, and, of course, a political class that seems to be corrupt, endlessly corrupt. Malware in your computers, ad-click fraud, and on and on and on. And she warns that this is a bad trend, this trend to becoming a low-trust society. She says, the internet is increasingly a low-trust society, one where an assumption of pervasive fraud is simply built into the way many things function. She says, people do adapt to low-trust societies, of course. Word-of-mouth recommendations from familiar sources become more important. Doing business with family and local networks start taking precedence. But also mafia-like organizations spring up. imposing a kind of accountability at a brutal cost. And ultimately, and this is maybe the most scary sentence in this article, people in low-trust societies may welcome an authoritarian ruler, someone who will impose order and consequences from on high. Sure, the tyrant's also corrupt and cruel, but the alternative is the tiring, immiserating absence of everyday safety and security. I love this line. During the reign of Kublai Khan, it was said, a maiden bearing a nugget of gold on her head could wander safely throughout the realm. The great Khan required absolute submission, and even repression has some perks. What do you think? I'll let you start, Jeff, because I think latency is kind of killing your ability to converse. So why don't you start?
Sorry.
No, it's not your fault.
Well, I also just put another piece up in the rundown, at the bottom of the rundown, which is related, I think, which is Mike Godwin wrote a piece in Reason, inspired by Neal Stephenson's new and very thick 800-page novel.
Which I have finished.
He's not through it yet.
Which I have finished.
You're ahead of Mike.
Yeah.
In which he argues that maybe this the cure for disinformation is disinformation. Maybe when we all distrust everything, maybe that's where we need to get to.
Yeah, you could tell Mike hasn't finished the novel, by the way. So
right.
what happens in the novel, and I think I might have brought this up, it's fascinating. What happens in the novel is one important character, Maeve, is being slimed by trolls, never happens, right, on the internet. Just completely her reputation is being trashed for no apparent reason. It's almost a Gamergate situation. And a geek comes up with a great idea. He creates many, many bots to put out information, misinformation, information of all kinds about Maeve, flood the internet with it so that when you go on the net, you can't tell, you know, anything you read about Maeve is bogus because there's so much of it. She's a leftist. She's a rightist. She's a feminist. She hates women. You put up enough contradictory, bogus information, none of it is trusted. And so it drowns out the trolling. Well, he hasn't finished the novel because the consequence of this is, and I think I mentioned this, that it's a spoiler, but it's not going to spoil the novel. It's a great novel. People who have enough money will hire editors on the internet, human curators, to try to give you decent information. People who can't afford that, which is the vast majority, will be fed such a volume of phony fake news that the country splits into faction, people who believe in vaccinations, people who don't. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. They were there already.
Yeah. So that there's no crazy theory that doesn't have its adherents. And as a result, it is very dangerous because as you travel through the country, you go into the different zone. There's a zone where people don't believe in Christ's crucifixion. They think that was a fiction that was promulgated by somebody who didn't want anybody, for whatever reason. They had some crazy, cracked reason. So they go around crucifying people to prove it's not real. It's just weird. Neal Stephenson is a great thinker about the future. I think sometimes not a great writer. Some of his wrote some of my favorite novels, but he also has some difficulty finishing them. And I'm sad to say The Fall does not end in a very coherent way. However, it's a fascinating novel full of great ideas. But that is a very interesting
idea. Is it worth reading?
888 pages.
I don't know. How long did it take? Did you listen?
I listened and read. I have a new method, which really works well, is to buy the Kindle version and the audiobook version and go back and forth so I could really. And I was trying. Remember we talked about that New York Times article by a novelist saying people should stop binging TV and start binging novels? Mm-hmm. I wanted to give that a chance. He said, you know, there were novels written to be binged, to be immersive in this world. So immerse yourself. Don't read 8 pages at a time, which is what I do, like most people.
I feel like Stacey, Neil also.
Go ahead, Matt, and then Stacey.
I love his books, but I would agree that I'm concerned if the book is that length. Lots of times he spends pages and pages describing, you know, the rotation of the Earth or the way that certain, and it's fascinating, but I often wonder whether, you know, maybe just a paragraph or two about that would be better.
Yeah. Well, you will. Here's the best part about this novel.
It's still shorter than Infinite Jest.
Yeah. No, it is. And I still haven't finished Infinite Jest. I have tried and tried and tried.
I did.
Okay. You're a better man than I.
Yeah, it was like Everest. Yeah.
The funny thing about this novel was it will make you question reality. So that's interesting.
It sounds like reality. It basically sounds like he's just describing what's happening right now.
I mean, you know what? It is worth reading. It is well worth reading. It's hard to say whether it's a great novel or just well worth reading, but it's well worth reading. Go ahead, Stacey.
I have no idea now what I was going to say. Wasn't that important.
I'm sorry.
My fault.
The thing, and people have been talking about this with Stevenson, and he's even been giving interviews about this, is this novel's clearly written to as a commentary on modern society and what the internet and fake news and trolling and all of this have done. But the central theme of the novel is, you know how they always said they cut off Walt Disney's head and froze it so that in a future culture that would figure out how to revive the brain, they could revive the brain. Well, in this near future, they realize that's a terrible kind of mechanical way of doing it. Well, all we really need to do is scan the brain to create the connectome of all of the interconnections between all the neurons, and then we can easily simulate the brain's activity in some future computer that has the capacity. It turns out to be quantum computers, but some future computers that have the capacity to recreate life. And then,
which is the plot of Coercion, isn't it? I haven't read it yet.
I haven't read that either. But
it's another new novel that's out.
At least half the book is the upshot of that. And it goes into the distant future, as some of many
in Coercion, having just read the reviews, people have false memories. They believe they have a child they don't have.
Yeah.
And when the child they don't have dies, they can't handle it. So even in their own life. So we're grappling with this question
is reality? What are facts?
I mean,
the big change of the internet was that it made facts inexpensive. Which was a big shift in the way and what we think of as knowledge. Facts were universal. But then what happened is facts got so devalued that you got alternate facts, and they were indistinguishable from factual facts.
And I think that to go back to what Zeynep was saying, the idea of trust, this is something I've talked with a bunch of people about as trust relates to journalism. Lots of projects and resources and experiments and companies are devoted to trust and increasing trust, and journalistic outlets want to build trust, and all of which is great. And I'm not saying those things aren't valuable, but the concept of trust as it applies to journalism is a very, very squishy concept and very difficult to kind of grapple with. Lots of people trust Breitbart. Lots of people trust their crazy uncle who believes all these incredible conspiracy theories. The trust, you know, in that sense, doesn't mean, it just means I trust this person or this news outlet to give me what I expect.
Right. That's why it's so dangerous to have word of mouth become everyone's de facto standard. And
And this is what Jeff was saying about moving back towards a more oral culture. Twitter, in a lot of ways, is a lot more like speaking than it is like writing or publishing, where it's in a weird place in between those two things. But to the extent that it's a lot more the way oral cultures used to be, it can actually exaggerate problems in a way that text did not.
In the early days of text, text was not trusted because text was full of mistakes. Right. And anybody could make text, and all you trusted was the people you trusted telling you what was going on.
So we've been here before.
Complete reversal.
Oh yeah,
we've been here.
Yeah, we've definitely been here before.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love you, Stacey.
No, I love you, Stacey. No,
yep.
We're going to talk about tech and Google.
Not going to go there. Not going to go there. Well, yeah, but I mean, this is in a global way, kind of what has tech wrought, and I think it's important to talk about the outcomes as much.
This is very related. Like, I mean, YouTube has a disinformation problem.
Yeah.
YouTube's recommendation algorithm has a disinformation problem. That's a tech partially.
And boy, is YouTube in trouble now, right? The FTC is
not
active.
A tech problem. It's a human problem.
It's a human problem.
People feed weaknesses in a system and exploit it.
Yeah. Right. Go ahead, Stace. Yeah.
Well, so we trust people. We see people, and we don't as people make the distinction between expertise. Like, I trust you, Matthew, on media issues, but if you tried to explain to me quantum computing, I probably wouldn't trust you that much. But for most people, we don't make those distinctions because, you know, like, right. I like you, Matthew. Of course you're going to not lead me wrong. And I don't think you intentionally would. But, you know, and I think we're stuck in this. And then as so you've got that layer, people are not very they don't appreciate the nuances of what they should trust from people. And then the other thing is we have this abusive culture, this capitalistic culture where you're like, you need to monetize your followers' trust, and mm-hmm. you may end up doing that to their detriment. And, you know, that's it. You're not doing that, Matthew, but, you know, that's kind of where we are in the influencer culture, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to get out from that, and I don't know if... Well, and Google, I think it was a problem, too, in writing. It's just it costs more to write, so you wouldn't want to have to...
That's a good point. There's a lot more of it now.
Exactly.
But again, we can also hear voices who were not heard before. Right. So we've got to come back to the positives that we were in a controlled old white man world.
Right.
Right. The world that was supposedly trusted was old white men saying, trust me. And there were a lot of people who didn't and didn't have the opportunity to say so. And now Stacey can say right here, I don't trust you, old white guy.
But that's why this is. But that's why this is so challenging. Because of course we wanted to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a lot of the voices who are now empowered are not good, trustworthy voices.
Right.
We'll figure it out.
And it's a case of you know, be careful what you wish for. I mean, if I know in the early days, and I'm sure Jeff was the same, and Leo, you probably were too.
Oh, we were
early
bullish.
Days of Twitter, early days of internet, early days of blogging. Yeah. This is great. The democratization of information. It's super fantastic. It's going to be awesome. Everybody's going to, you know, be able to speak and exchange information, and that is all true. But we've seen many, many downsides to that.
So, Stacey, I think you and I agree, maybe not, but I think you and I agree that the best solution to this is a literate, an educated public, right? That you can't.
Yes.
The tech community can't be expected to fix this unilaterally. The best thing would be for you're right in the middle of it. You have a 7-year-old or 8-year-old, and you're dealing with this right now.
I have a 12-year-old.
But
yes, she is. But I am teaching her to be more literate. I will say, though, that there are very insidious things that the tech companies do for engagement purposes that make it hard. It's not just dark patterns. It's also, I mean, as educated as I might make my daughter, she's still 12, right? And up until she's probably 20 something, she's going to have some certain thought patterns that are, you know, just the same as young people everywhere. She's going to tend towards, she's going to tend towards extreme. She's going to see the world much more in black and white. You know, and these aren't bad things. These are good things in some cases, but it also means that people can take advantage of that, and it's very easy to harness take advantage of that and then direct that through the internet for good or ill. I mean, that's kind of why Obama's campaign way back in 2008 was so successful, because it harnessed some of that youthful idealism and directed it towards action.
Did you read that article about written by the mother whose teen became radicalized through YouTube? Wasn't that frightening?
That was horrifying.
It had a happy ending, but horrible.
So Google
but
has
also,
a...
as Leo was saying earlier, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff. No.
If we go back to our youth, us two old white guys here, Matthew, you're Canadian, so we were going to run to you.
There are three of y'all.
I'm pretty young.
I'm leaving him off. I mentioned the novel Revolutionaries, which I finished recently too, and it goes through the downfall of the 60s, right? The good of the 60s, then the worst of the 60s, then 60s becoming a parody of itself. And when we were young, we were that mob, and we had a good cause trying to get out of the Vietnam War and equal rights, civil rights. But Stacey, we were like that too.
I mean, it's not
good.
The way your brain works at that age and the lack of experience.
So Google has a digital safety and citizenship curriculum. They call it Be Internet Awesome. I'm not sure what age this is aimed at, but I would guess middle school.
95. I think about 95 is what it should be.
Smart, alert, strong, kind, brave. This is the newest part. This just came out this month. This is a collaboration between Google, the Net Safety Collaborative, and the Internet Keep Safe Coalition. So the idea here is digital citizenship and safety. The Internet Code of Awesome. This is according to Google. I'll read it to you. This is aimed at middle schoolers. Share with care. Be internet smart. Don't fall for fake. Be internet alert. Secure your secrets. Be internet strong. It's cool to be kind. Be internet kind. When in doubt, talk it out. Be internet brave. Those seem like good precepts, especially for younger kids, kids your daughter's age.
Stacey, what do you think your daughter's view of that would be?
She does a lot of this already. So they've had training on this. I will say it's a little vague, maybe.
That's the table of contents. There are many activities.
Oh, no, there's a lot.
There's a lot, okay, but let's go to the new one, which is "Don't fall for fake," because this
so
is.
I think that could actually be valuable. And the rest of it, I think, is pretty.
Remember, I'll tell you why. I think that parents and educators don't have a guideline for this, and so maybe it's not perfect, but this gives them. I don't disagree with anything that's in here, and it gives them a good starting point for this conversation. With kids, and this is the new part here. We'll go right to it, which is don't fall for fake. And this is designed to teach media literacy with kids. Let me see if I can, that's share with care. And this is all available online for educators.
And I can tell you what she's already been doing. Like her teachers have done, at least for since she was in fourth or even maybe third grade, she's been doing digital literacy online.
Good.
So, and they even had me come as a journalist and talk to them about how I find
good.
And source
information. Is that a public school or a private school?
That was a private school.
I wonder what kind of education they were getting in the public schools in Austin. I don't know.
Well, it's Texas. So.
All right, let's look. Yeah, let's see if you can. Right. Let's see if you can. You can do the lesson two. Be internet alert. Don't fall for fake. Staying away from phishing and scams. That's kind of an interesting. The themes, it's important for kids to understand the content they find online. Is it necessarily true or reliable? And could involve malicious efforts to steal their information or identity. I don't know if that's the focus I'd want to take on this. But
speaking of phishing, did you see that horrible story from Alaska? A teen killed her friend because she was someone online told her they'd pay her millions of dollars if she.
So this is what you want to avoid, right? Mm-hmm. There's catfishing, there's clickbait, there's spear phishing and phishing. They define all these terms. Should we look through and see if we would pass this test? It has activities. Is it things to ask? Is it asking for your personal information? Is the email offering you something for free?
I think a lot of online games that like my daughter plays, they actually do a lot of this training there.
There are apps designed to do that, aren't there?
Well, no. It's not. It's just as part of like she plays. I know I've talked to you about Star Stables, good Lord. But she still plays that. But she learned a lot of her chat room etiquette, both I think in school and maybe a little bit for me. And then a ton from both the kids on the forum and then the forum rules itself.
That's great.
Like, wow.
And peer education at that age is the most valuable education, isn't it? I mean, your peers are who teach you.
Yeah, there's value. Like when I was in high school, I did a thing called PALS, and it was peer assisted leadership, I think is what it stood for. And we went to elementary and middle schools and buddied up with a kid, and we'd hang out with them for that period once a week. And I wonder if having creating some sort of digital PAL program where high schoolers, just hang out and spend a computer period with younger kids and try to explain the world. Part of it, I think parents are just so afraid of telling their kids the world is an awful, scary, bad place.
They want to do Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy.
And lots of them
I don't blame them.
Aren't that savvy either.
Yeah, that's why I think curricula like this is great, because you don't have to be savvy to go through this. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, parents could do this with their kids. They give you fake and real phishing scams. You know, is this real? Who are you? Is it okay to
definitely good steal profile photos? It's definitely good to do it before you get to the sort of teens, because I know when I was a teen, this stuff would have been ridiculed and scorned. And so if you get them earlier than that,
before, everything from an adult is bull for teens. Yeah.
I think if you gave this to a teenager right now, they'd laugh at you. They know all this stuff. Like my daughter knew this at the age of 10.
Yeah.
The most important thing,
grandpa doesn't.
Yeah, honestly, you're right. Yeah. That's what you were saying. Is this is really for old farts?
I mean, the kids aren't messing up the world.
Yeah.
There was a study I mentioned on the show before that was done out of Princeton and NYU that 90-odd% of a corpus of fake news that they got was being shared by people who looked like the three of us, except you, Stacey.
Well, how about this one? Here's a story by a guy named Robert Heaton. He's a software engineer. And he says, I was 7 words away from being spearfished. He got what can seem to be a real email from the University of Cambridge asking him to judge the Adam Smith Prize for Economics.
Are you sure your award is real, Matthew? Yeah. Are you positive?
Yeah, I should maybe look into it.
I should point out that Robert is not an economist. He's a software developer. He says, I've read Capital in the 21st Century, but he wasn't suspicious. He was suspicious enough to do all the things we would say do. For instance, he looked at the link in the email, which was to Cambridge University. And in fact, a personal account, was the address. He said, it did strike me a little odd. The page was hosted inside a personal directory, but it was on the Cambridge website. He visited the root to make sure it really was the domain. He Googled the fella. He couldn't find much, but he said not everybody has a Twitter profile. He noticed some grammatical or typos, errors, but he did reply. He said, thank you. I'm certainly interested, but tell me more. What would it involve and who recommended me? They went back and forth. He actually visited the page. He realized that he was just lucky, because the page he visited, had he visited it with Firefox, would have stolen his passwords. It's an attack we talked about yesterday on Security Now. There was a 0-day in Firefox.
Interesting.
And he visited on Google Chrome. The 7 words, he said, if the page had just said, must be viewed in Firefox, he might have launched Firefox. He had it. And
they
would
got crypto.
Yeah.
They got coin.
Yeah. So what happened is they used it to attack Coinbase employees. And because if you store, and this is just a great tip for everybody, don't use your browser to store passwords. Use a password manager. In this case, Firefox, which is normally a very secure browser, had a flaw that allowed an attacker to, on a web page without your knowledge, to steal your passwords, your Firefox passwords. It was used against Coinbase. In fact, a lot of crypto was stolen from Coinbase, I believe. And so that's what he got bit by. And he said, in every respect, this looked kind of real, except it wasn't. And so that just points out, this is hard stuff.
Yeah.
So what did he pull back? What made him finally pull back and say, what was the last straw?
He didn't pull back. The point is, he did the research. Had he done it in Firefox, he would have been hacked. He was lucky he used Chrome. The next one might be Chrome. So the point is merely that he was lucky. And had the attackers just gone one step farther and said, use Firefox to view this, he would have thought, oh, those guys can't figure out how to make it work in Chrome. Okay.
And I think we've talked about this before. A lot of the most successful sort of phishing and even hacking is just relationship management, or it's getting people to convincing people to give you things, not necessarily 0-day exploits. It's all
social engineering,
right?
Exactly, social engineering. And I know
ego engineering.
I've got half a dozen friends whose parents, elderly parents, have been this close to sending money to somebody, because they believed the story that somebody told them.
But this is how easy it is, and this is a sophisticated guy. He's a software engineer. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad he wrote that.
It's really a generous act for
yes,
it's,
it is.
It's not easy
it's
on
embarrassing.
Your ego to admit
yeah.
that you're right.
Yeah.
But that's really important.
And the reason this worked is because he was flattered that they would ask him to judge the Adam Smith Prize for Economics, even though he's not an economist.
I'm just sitting here thinking, like, I would totally never even fall for that. I'd be like, no, this is not real, because my ego would be like,
this has been around.
No, I'm not an economist.
This has been around for decades, because I know, Jeff, you've received this snail mail, and I have too, inviting you to be in Who's Who.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Who's Who piece.
You have to pay.
Yeah. You have to buy it. Well, certainly you would want a copy of Who's Who with your name in it. I think back, because I remember my dad was included in Who's Who, and I'm thinking maybe that was the same scam.
Maybe.
I mean, they were doing it when I was in high school.
They had to have. If you care, Zuck is on stage, I think, now at the Aspen Institute.
Can we pull it up?
I don't know. I just saw, so.
What is he talking about?
It just
he made a surprise appearance. Cass Sunstein is interviewing him. People complain that it's not a journalist. I missed your line, Andrew. Matthew.
I said he announced he was stepping down.
Yeah. From the stage.
Yeah, it doesn't look like they stream that. I guess you have to pay some money.
Oh, okay. All right.
They do. Bucks. Yeah. It's a pretty expensive conference.
Yeah. It's the Aspen Institute. So we'll read about that in TechCrunch tomorrow. All right, let's take... we don't need to take a break.
Well, it is streamed, if you care.
Oh, it is.
It's on YouTube.
I don't think that the controversial part of this is choice. I think that the harder part to define is your information. Right, so I think that, you know, take it in the context of a social system. You know, one of the things that Facebook does is it shows you your friends' birthdays. Right, so it can remind you of your friends' birthdays. Okay. We try to enable a developer ecosystem so that way people can bring their information out to other developers. I don't think anyone, I would be very surprised if anyone in this room disagreed with the notion that you should be able to take your information from a service to another service, right? I mean, that's non-controversial. The question is, all right, I have my friends on Facebook. You know, you're my friend. You share with me your birthday. Facebook reminds me of that. Am I allowed to take that birthday and put it in my calendar app? And should Facebook enable doing that so that now my other calendar that I use
it's just
can remind
helping
me of my
people
friend's
do
birthdays.
What they want.
Is your birthday my information or yours? Who gets to decide that? If I want to export my friend's birthdays to a calendar, do I need to ask every single one of them for their permission? Because if I do, then that app probably isn't going to get built, because that's a lot of friction. Or let's talk about another example. Newsfeed, right? I mean, one of the things that people have talked about for a while is, hey, wouldn't it be nice if I could bring my newsfeed, the content that I see from my friends, to another app, either so that there could be competing newsfeeds, right? So another company could innovate on top of that, or academics could do research on top of that. I mean, a lot of people want to be able to have people come in for studies and say, all right, can I see what's in your feed? And can I pull that data and then do a study on the content that's there, you know, including for reasons like the election issues. I mean, there are a lot of academics who want to study this stuff. Same issue. You know, the content that you see in your feed, it's photos and links that your friends have shared. Is that your information or theirs? And if it's theirs, then and you give them a choice over whether you're allowed to pull it out. And let's say we're overwhelmingly successful and say that 90% of people opt in and say, I'm willing to let my friends share that information, then, you know, are the studies that are done on that going to be valid? You know, are you really going to be able to build a competitive news feed if 10% of your friends' most interesting information is not there and the only way to get the full experience is through Facebook? These are really hard questions, I think. Right, I actually come out more on the side of where you are, that this should be left to individual choice. But I don't want to leave the impression that these are obvious choices that don't have competing equities that we all value greatly. If your paramount concern is around innovation and competition and research and data portability, and then it's not clear that you want to give every individual the right to say, I don't want my information to be able to be taken to another service. So I think that this is very connected to the set of privacy debates and things that we're having as well. There's no question in my mind that people need to have the right to be able to say who has access to their information. But I do think that as a society, there is we need to decide where we want to be on the spectrum between asking companies to fully lock down people's information and, on the other hand, making it portable. Because right now...
I think he's making a reasonable point. I hate to say it.
He doesn't let academics access the news feed.
Right.
So that's one of his examples is something that he doesn't actually happen. Let.
Right.
It doesn't happen.
Well, they started SSRC, but they're gun shy because of Cambridge.
Well, a lot of people would point out.
They were gun shy way prior to, they came down very hard on people in 2015.
Nobody really is disputing that Facebook guards the information it has about you carefully. That's frankly a value to them. It's a financial value. That's not the problem. It's what the information, what they do with the information they have about you, not what I do with my birthdays or the news feed or what they do with the information that's problematic.
It's in his interest to cheat, to take the most they innocuous
focus,
example.
Yes.
Right. And get you, because of course you would agree.
By the way, it's also in his interest, and this is something everybody does now, to say, oh no, we protect your data carefully. We work really hard to protect your data. They do, because they don't want,
they want a
competitor to get it. they do protect it. Nobody's disputing that whatever Facebook knows about you, it keeps to itself.
Well, and it reminds me of those congressional hearings when everybody focused on, you know, why do you sell data? You shouldn't be allowed to sell data. And that was an easy argument to refute because they don't sell data.
Right.
So all Mark had
they
to say
sell
was we don't sell
you.
Data, which is true.
Right.
We give it away.
Right.
And then people give us money in exchange for what they can do with it.
But they don't. I mean, if you go to Facebook and say, I want to know how old Leo Laporte is, you can't, as an advertiser, you can't get that information. You can say, no. I want everybody between 45 and 55.
I want a real white man. You can do it. Yeah.
Well, actually, white you can't do it. It's important in aggregate.
Because they don't want it. Yeah, they don't, but they wouldn't want to give my information to some other person because somebody could then compile a database and sell against them. They keep, all these companies keep this private to themselves unless they can sell the data in aggregate. And usually that's for advertising purposes. So,
Stacey, you're quite right about the research. It's been a huge frustration for researchers.
They'd love this information.
Want to be able to find out the impact. And Alex Stamos is really articulate about this, about saying, okay, well, here's where they're stuck.
Sorry, now my computer's making too much noise. Go ahead. I've muted it.
I'm done.
Stacey, did you want to respond? Or he's just saying you're right.
Wait. What?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear.
Just say thank you.
I was saying you're
thank
right.
Thank you.
You were right.
Oh, no, Jeff. This is terrible.
This can't go
this
on.
This whole show is predicated on us disagreeing. Come on, man.
No.
Oh, but it's more fun.
No.
I'm feeling feistier
today. I think you're
wrong
about that.
No. You're wrong, Stacey.
Are you ready to engage, Stacey? Are you going to?
Stacey just disagreed that it's good to agree. So there we are.
Who's right?
Just that.
I'm just having fun now.
So
that's what Stacey called fun. See, we got it. Yeah, Stacey, I get it.
Yeah.
A new bipartisan bill. Mark Warner from Virginia and Josh Hawley, our favorite Republican from Missouri.
Great law.
The Dashboard Act.
Stupidest. Idea for legislation ever made.
By the way, an acronym, maybe a retronym, Designing Accounting Safeguards to Help Broader Oversight and Regulations on Data Dashboard. Yeah. The idea is consumers should know what their information is worth to Google, to Facebook, to Amazon.
Sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, what could be wrong with that?
What about, you know how we talked last week about ambient privacy?
Yeah.
I think sometimes you can't sell your information without outing other people, right? Or you can't, there's a lot here. I don't think you shouldn't be allowed to sign away your data rights or your privacy rights for money, because that puts the onus on people who don't have money.
So they're not saying here we're going to give you money for it. They're saying under this act, companies are required. I think this sounds like GDPR. to disclose what kind of data they they collect, the value of that data. Okay, we could say, you know, what? So
that's the funny thing.
That's silly. And how the data is used. So we'll just take that value.
Fine
part
on points
out.
One and three. Point two is what's got the headlines, though. And point two is the stupid part.
Yeah, we'll take that.
I mean, transparency is good.
Transparency, although.
They would have to file an annual report disclosing the harvested user's data aggregate value along with any third-party contracts regarding such information. Again, this is all a red herring, which, by the way.
Leo, I think you have to reveal the value of every viewer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I could do a math calculation and say.
But you wouldn't want to do that. You don't want to.
No, I could gladly do that. No, in fact, I know what the value of every viewer is because that's how we charge for advertising.
I don't.
It's like you all are priceless.
We charge $90 per 1,000 listeners or viewers. So that means you're each worth about a nickel or a dime. I don't know. Yeah, money, man.
Nice.
Money makes that Velcro.
But so, you know, that value thing, this is ridiculous. Data's aggregate value, third-party contracts regarding such information. Yeah, I mean, we already know that that doesn't work. But this is important. Give users the ability to delete all or specific portions of their data. This is like GDPR. Okay. What data you collect, how the data is used.
Just said, I tell you it's my birthday. You say, congratulations, Jeff. It's Jeff's birthday. You make a post out of that. Yeah. Do I have the freedom to make you take that down? That's the kind of question you get into.
Well, and Facebook has intentionally intermingled all of this to make it hard. In fact, when you delete your Facebook account, when you delete your Facebook account, they even say, well, we're going to delete everything you in your account, but there may be pictures of you. There may be stuff that people have saved that you've said. We can't do anything about that. And of course you can't. I wouldn't expect
not only that.
I put it on the internet.
I guarantee if they implemented some of the deletion or some of the other points that they mentioned in there, it would be buried 15 submenus deep on a page that would be incomprehensible and no one would ever do it.
They also said they would that the additional transparency would encourage market competition and allow antitrust enforcers to identify potentially anti-competitive practices. That might be the reason for the dollar amount. Maybe. I mean, we're not senators. Maybe there's some technical.
No, the reason for the dollar amount is it got up headlines.
Yeah,
and it worked.
Yeah.
You guys can be cynical. So can I.
Well, and it may not just be for headlines. It could also be like, hey, each person is really only 10 cents for us. This isn't worth it. You know, you could make a lot of arguments about. Look, this is not, we measure most of our harms today in economics, right? In dollars. So if we can put a value on the data or a value on the harm it might cause, then we can actually,
Facebook can make the same,
can deal with it.
Facebook can make the same calculus I just did. Based, if you divide their revenue by the number of users, it's $6.42 per user worldwide, $30 per user in the Canada and U.S. Yeah, in the U.S. and Canada, you're worth more, $30. That's all. That's
now with
almost,
Google, you can't really do that because you've got other services.
Right.
And Amazon, you've got other services like AWS and things.
Yeah. By the way, MarketWatch is glad to say, just a factoid, 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are created every day. If you laid 2.5 quintillion pennies out flat, they would cover the earth five times.
That was useful.
Okay. Yeah, that's handy.
This is why Jeff teaches journalism students about data journalism. This is not data journalism.
I'm disappointed they didn't use the international measuring system, which is the football field.
Well, I'm surprised they didn't tell us how many Library of Congress it would, you know.
It just it cracks me up that they decided to illustrate the fact that 2.5 quintillion bytes of data are created every day by saying if those were pennies, they would cover the earth five times. It just cracks me up.
They didn't even say what a quintillion was.
They probably didn't know. Sometimes, I'll be honest, when I'm looking up some of these big data numbers, I'm like, oh, God, how many zeros is that? Wait, what?
They must have known because that's a lot of calculations. You got to divide the total surface area of the globe.
Yeah.
Oh, no, dude, that was in a press release somewhere, and they just cut and pasted.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, would somebody please check that for us? What is the area of a penny, And what is the you'd have to do it in squares, even though a penny is round.
The Earth. Yeah.
And what is the total surface square footage of the Earth, or square penny-age of the Earth? And then it.
However, in Canada, you couldn't do that because I learned today. I paid for my latte, $6.03 with 3 cents, and the woman said, "Oh, you're using pennies. We don't use pennies anymore." Yeah. Why don't you explain this to me?
So the surface area of the Earth is 5.49 times 10 to the 15th square feet. So there, we're going to help you a little bit. Now, Google, what is the surface area of a penny? I bet Wolfram Alpha could do this calculation.
I'm sure the chat room.
Oh, yeah.
Surface area of a penny. Well, wait a minute. Front and back? No. It is 0.442 square inches.
Was it surface area or depth? Were they stacked surface or area. They laid side to side?
No, laid side by side.
Like, wait, well, there's some of them are stacked because it's five times over.
It is.
If it was going to the moon, you would stack them.
It is a quarter the area of a human retina. It is a 60% of a typical postage stamp. So I'm sure if I do surface area of the penny. Cover. I mean, how many? Let's just ask it. How many pennies would it take to cover the Earth? Wolfram Alpha is amazing on stuff like this. There you go. 1.4 times 10 to the 18th. So it's done. That's it. Wolfram Alpha. How many is in
is
a
that
quintillion?
The same number?
Is yeah,
that
the so same now number? We just have to find out what a quintillion is.
What about going up and down mountains? Do pennies float? They don't.
I think the number is actually wrong.
Yeah, I think their number's wrong.
Their number's wrong. In fact, a quintillion, what is it, 2.5 quintillion, four
it's
and a half?
10 to the what?
2.5 quintillion pennies would barely cover a quarter of the Earth. Okay, a quintillion
wow,
is 10
is
to the
a scandal.
10 to the 18th.
What was the original stat that we're trying to
I
get
forgot.
To?
2.5 quintillions.
Okay, so a quintillion, so 2.5 quintillions, it would cover the Earth twice. So you're wrong.
So
you're wrong, Market
times.
Watch.
It said five times.
They said five times.
Pretty sure they just made it up because who's going to check?
That's because they used all the extra Canadian pennies nobody's using anymore.
Well, that's a good point. What kind of penny? A British penny has a lot more surface area.
You know, it costs, I think, 3 cents to make a penny.
That's why they won't take it.
Matthew, so when my bill was $6.03 and she was so amazed I gave her
three pennies
exact change, do they round up to $6.05?
Yeah.
Usually, yeah.
Wait, why did they? Where did you get pennies?
You paid in dollars at a Canadian place?
I had a bag of change
Canadian
at home
dollars. Canadian
that I carry with me, and I had tons of change, and I had a lot of pennies because you don't use them. So I shocked her. I gave her $6.03. She said, "Oh,
were they American pennies?"
No, they were Canadian pennies.
No, they were old. They were vintage Canadian pennies.
I have Canadian pennies at home as well, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So did she accept them? Is it still legal tender?
Yes, she did. She said, "Oh, it's okay. Yeah. Like you poor dumb American. Okay, it's all right.
We have to take it."
Yeah, they're Canadian. They're going to take it.
Stock up on loonies. That's the best. Loonies are the best.
Loonies.
Well, I tried to give a guy a euro instead of a loonie today, and he said, "I'll take the euro. I'll be happy to, but it's not the right one."
Canadians are so nice.
While we're in stupid legislators' ideas, there's another one in the government section. Thune.
Is it the Section 230 one?
No.
That's another one.
That's just dangerous. This one is that he wants Google to require to give you search without an algorithm.
Oh, right. No algorithms. That's right.
That's like, I'm going to have a trash fire. I mean, like, it's like going to the dump and asking to see like your mail.
I'm going to give you the entire screen of the entire internet. Good luck.
I think Senator Thune does not know what an algorithm is. I do not think that word means what you think
or
it does.
Internet is, or Google is.
He says,
"We want." Hey, bye. So you want these guys to be running the internet? No.
Well, wait a minute, though. There is some reasonable. So, for instance, in the Facebook news feed, if they would just give me in chronological order all the shares from the people I follow.
You can have that now.
But it turns it off.
And Twitter, you can have that now.
Yeah, but it turns it off.
Yeah, you can have it.
They turn it back.
It's not.
I'm constantly fighting that.
It's a horrible experience, but fine. Go ahead. Let's get off my nose.
I always did that. It's a much better experience than the algorithmic one. So that's what he's saying is not unreasonable. Although Facebook would say we already give you that. Google, how a Google search could be non-algorithmic. What does that even mean?
It wouldn't work.
It means browsing. It means you aimlessly browse.
It's Yahoo.
Maybe it would look like Yahoo, or as Matthew said, alphabetical, or maybe it could be chronological. Like this is the most recent.
Yahoo is highly selective.
Oh, I love this. Imagine if you do an internet search and it gives you the results in alphabetical order.
It'd be like the phone book. A conspiracy theory 102.
Taxi company.
And then gaming it would be easy.
Yeah.
You just like they do the phone book. That's why there's so many muffler shops named AAAAAA muffler shop.
Were you and I on a Twitter discussion this week about great old website of the day stuff?
Yeah. I mentioned Dogpile. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
That
was an aggregator. Would aggregate the results from many different sites.
I also pointed out that this is another little humble brag. I had a website called High Tech Investor, if you can believe it, because I worked for the stock market
securities
section of the paper.
Yeah.
And it was literally just a list of places you could get stock quotes, because there were only about a dozen of them at the time. Yeah. And this was 1995. So that was Worth Magazine's website of the day in 1995.
Congratulations.
I had a few cool sites of the day.
Thank you.
Yuckiest site on the internet was a cool site of the day.
Wait a minute. Yuckiest. That was your site, was the yuckiest site on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
Were you doing porn?
Wait a minute. Tell me this again. You had a site called
the yuckiest site on the internet.
Okay. Well, at least
it was in collaboration with Liberty Science Center. It was about snot and cockroaches and all.
Oh, nice.
It was an effort to learn how to make sites. My very first site I made on the internet was called Rain or Shine, because I hate TV weathermen. And I said, just give me the damned 5-day forecast and nothing but. So it was a site that gave you nothing but the 5-day forecast.
Wow. It's
called Rain or Shine, which we sold to AccuWeather. And we sold Yuckiest Site to Discovery.
Because later on, one of my favorite sites was Do I Need a Jacket, I think it was called. And that's all I told you.
By the way, I think you can now do that with Amazon's Echo.
Canada, it was just a gift that said yes.
Yes, always. Where are you? Oh, yeah, you need a jacket. Always. So that's John Thune, somebody needs to explain to him that you could do that with Facebook, but it's nonsense to say a Google search that has no algorithm is nonsense.
It would be useless, yeah.
And to pass a law.
And I would say this also plays into something else we've referred to, which is this tendency on the right and in the Trump administration to argue that these sites are biased against them.
Should we play the video?
To get rid of bias.
Yes, play the video. It's unbelievable.
So
the Trump.
And notice that Maria Bartiromo doesn't question his assertion at all.
You know, when Maria Bartiromo talked about finance, I used to like her, but
she went to the dark side.
She kind of did go over. So
she's a TV host.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. She's a TV host. All right, so let me pause this. This is the president on the phone with Fox Business with Maria Bartiromo. Let me see. Oh, I've muted him again. I keep doing that. Let me unmute.
I think that's against the law now, Leo.
I'm not allowed to mute the president. All right.
And they're going to do this right up to the 2020 election.
Well, you got to go back. You got to go back.
I mean, what they did.
I thought that was the beginning.
And they're going to do this right up to the 2020 election.
Well, they're doing it to me on Twitter. I mean, what they did to me on Twitter is incredible. I have millions and millions of followers.
Wait a minute. What did they do to him on Twitter?
Keep going.
Well, he's saying the algorithm is.
But I will tell you, they make it very hard for people to join me in Twitter, and they make it very much harder for me to get out the message. They make it.
Really?
It's incredible.
How do they do that, Mr. President?
What do you mean? These companies have an enormous amount of power.
Oh, shut up, Maria. Wait a minute. He says all you have to do is go to twitter.com/ The real Donald J. Trump.
She didn't question it. She just took it and ran with it. Oh, they're being so mean to you, Mr. President.
Click follow.
If they could even stop the president of the free world in terms of getting his message out.
Wait a minute. He's now the president of the free world?
That is what we call the president a lot.
It's totally biased toward Democrats.
No. We call him the leader of the free world. The president implies that he's elected.
Okay, yeah.
Leader is more a position of authority. President implies, he got elected president of the free world. Weren't you watching?
I announce tomorrow that I'm going to become a nice liberal Democrat. I would pick up five times more followers. I was picking up 100,000 followers every few days. And all of a sudden, and I'm much hotter now than I was a number of months ago. Okay, a number of months ago. Then all of a sudden it stopped. And now I pick up a lot, but I don't pick up nearly what I did a few. And
it's why Devin Nunes is suing Twitter right now.
Who's suing Twitter?
Devin Nunes, Congressman Nunes.
You know.
That's great. I think he's great. In a lot of ways, he's great. And he'll probably do well. He's right about it. Twitter is just terrible what they do.
This is so ironic.
You get the word. I've had so many people come to me.
Twitter is his platform. His platform.
He owns Twitter.
They have a special room with a shrine to Donald J. Trump in it. For him to say
he violates their terms of service all the time. They let him go.
That's hysterical. Yeah.
It's the newsworthy exception.
So he's going to sue Twitter.
Oh, Matthew, right?
He's going to sue Twitter, Facebook, and Google because they're totally biased towards Democrats. By the way, it's not illegal to be biased towards Democrats, or we would be in trouble.
May soon be.
He means bias in favor of Democrats.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying it's not illegal for a private company to have a bias.
Well, maybe soon it will be.
Okay.
I mean, that's where the Section 230 stuff comes in.
Right.
There's a bunch of people in the government who are arguing that platforms should be neutral, that their algorithms should not favor one thing or another, or that they shouldn't remove certain types of content. And their
argument is the point of an algorithm.
Right. But if they are not so-called neutral, they will lose Section 230 protection. That was last week's stupid law.
I know Larry Page is up in his special mountain lair thinking, we'll just make it all alphabetical. Then you'll see. Enjoy the internet, morons. He's made enough money. He doesn't, you know.
I think there's a Roadrunner cartoon in this of Acme winning finally.
God. Wow. That's just amazing. Google, by the way, has told its employees not to protest Google at the Pride Parade. So, yeah.
That's disturbing.
Do not. You can. So it was actually a debate about whether the Pride Parade should allow Googlers.
Jesus.
And then because of harassment of LGBTQ+ community members.
Oh, is that a thing that's been happening? I'm so sorry. I have not paid attention to that.
I don't know. And then, according to some, yes.
I also saw somebody I trust on Twitter. They was saying that now you've got the far right within Google doing things. You had Veritas went after, was it Google or a Facebook executive? So it's become, the technology companies have become red hot.
Well, they're terrified. They can't say anything in any direction because somebody will be mad about it. So anyway, now the Pride Parade will feature Googlers, but they won't be protesting against Google. Because it's Google said, and this is probably the case for every company, you have non-disparagement clause and you can't disparage the company you work for. So please don't. And you know what? What are they going to do? Arrest them? I don't even think they'd fire them.
Well, I think there's also a point of don't use the Pride Parade as the opportunity.
Yeah.
As a protest, you let the Pride Parade have its own dignity.
Yeah. I guess.
Have you been to a Pride Parade? I mean, they're a heap of fun. Gravitas is not what I associate.
It's hard to talk about dignity.
Yes, my friend.
If you're wearing assless chaps, there's not.
I covered Pride Parades in San Francisco when they started.
Good for you, Jeff.
But did you mark?
No, no.
By the way, the last time I used the phrase assless chaps, somebody wrote to me and said all chaps are assless.
Fair point.
Fair point.
Fair point.
Fair point.
Yes, fair
it's
point.
A redundancy.
It's the day of fair points.
It's just a great phrase. That's all. Wow, this show takes it out of me. I don't know. Is it take it out of you guys?
Kind of gone all the, let's see. Oh, can we talk about Blue Dot? Because I think that's really interesting.
Yes. Blue Dot. What is Blue Dot, Stacey?
I thought it was really good.
Oh, let me make sure. It is Blue Dot. Okay. That's also a furniture company. Yes. So I was like, oh, did I just screw that up? this is a employee. It's a peer-to-peer. They call it counseling, but it's really training a subset of your employees in compassionate listening, which is just open-minded listening, not trying to solve a problem and not making judgments.
Nice.
And
oh, this is Mark Google's mental health company run mental employee run mental health project. Yeah.
It is, yeah. It's an employee-run mental health effort. And these employees who are trained this way mark themselves with a blue dot on their badges. And I like the example of how this happens, which is you might be hanging out with somebody and or just like passing by, and if you're having a bad day or something, you're just like, oh, hey, you're a blue dot.
I love this idea.
Can I talk to you?
Great idea.
Yeah. So and we should do this.
Google collects no data on it.
Blue Dot volunteers don't coach people or even offer opinions. Well, they practice compassionate listening, promising openness and kindness to coworkers who come to them. That's a nice idea.
It started on its own, and then Google saw that they added training to it,
which is a good idea
of quality.
Yeah, 400 people.
I think it's great to do that.
So it sounds like this one woman uses her 20% time to manage like any sort of administrative tasks associated with it. So.
And of
I
course,
guess,
the joke is 20% time is 120% time.
Right. Right. Yes. I'm just pointing it out that that's where they say. I would assume that it would be difficult because if someone's like, hey, can I talk? You know, it's not like if you're working on something pressing, you don't want to be like, I have to get this
buzz
out
off
the door.
There is.
I know you're troubled right now, but.
There is definitely a trend in technology companies, and I would guess it's all companies these days, but there's definitely a trend in technology companies to acknowledge that there's depression, there are other psychological impacts to the long work hours, the hard work, the isolative nature of some of the work. And I think there's a very active movement within Silicon Valley and in tech companies in general to kind of acknowledge that and address it. And not in the more formal, traditional ways that an HR department might. You know, every company in the world has a sign saying, here's the 800 number. If you feel like, you know, it's not worth living, call this number. This is something much, I think, much more effective, much better. We just had to all take our harassment training. And among one of the things I really liked about this is State of the California mandated. So everybody had to do it. Management, including me, had to do an extra 2 hour. We had like a special 2 hour training. But the point of it, they kept emphasizing.
Really?
Yeah, they said the point of it is not to keep your company from getting sued. That's the point of it, by the way. But
of it is not to be a jerk to your coworkers.
That's right. The point of it is to make the workplace a respectful place to other, you know, and I thought that was really good. And they talked about listening and not having an opinion if there's an incident. To immediately take, take action and stuff. I was surprised. I was prepared to hate it. I had to take it. And, I hate the, anytime you work for a big company, I know you, Jeff, you know this anyway. And you have to take these trainings. For the radio show, iHeartMedia has so many consent decrees. I have an hour long training on why you shouldn't play the emergency tones on your radio show unless it's an actual emergency, because some dumb DJ in New Orleans did it, and now every iHeartRadio employee has to take this training on why not to. Obviously not a good idea, but there's a lot of them, and it's, you know, most of the time I hate it, but this one was, I thought, very very good. And I guess the state of California is requires us to do that. So I think there is a trend in this direction to making the workplace a kinder, gentler, more inclusive place. In California, you can't discriminate against somebody because of their gender choice, for instance, or their pronoun choice, or there's some really good, I think, fairly good rules that are completely appropriate. And I want to go on record saying that.
Noted. All right.
Thank you. No, I'm sincere.
No protest against you in the Pride Parade.
I am sincere. Please don't protest against me in the Pride Parade. So YouTube is in the hot seat a little bit. The Washington Post had a scoop that said that the government has in the late stages of an investigation of YouTube for violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act that forbids tracking and targeting of users younger than the age of 13. The probe launched after numerous complaints from consumer groups and privacy advocates because apparently YouTube has been somehow either failing to protect kids or improperly collecting their data. And
are they collecting data knowing it's from kids or just kids on YouTube and
they're another blip in the Google machine? You know, probably it's the latter, but that what they're saying is Google has to ascertain people's age. You can't just, you know, assume, well, they must be an adult because they have a YouTube account.
You have to assume they haven't lied and gotten, I mean.
Right. These companies, according to the Post, say their services are intended for adults and they take action when they find users who are underage. You know, Facebook says you can't join Facebook if you're under 13, but that doesn't stop.
Google won't give people email addresses unless But, you know, my daughter has an email, a Gmail address because, you know, I signed up for one for her because a 13-year-old without an email address is just ridiculous.
Pretty cray.
Now, why wouldn't you create like a kid's version of an account that just doesn't track anything? Because that's totally doable. But that would give up.
But then if you fail at it, your liability is probably higher. So,
well, reportedly, YouTube is considering moving all the kids' videos to YouTube Kids to like really make that a separate place. Maybe turn off autoplay on YouTube Kids by default. Maybe turn off all tracking.
Yeah. Turn off. They should have done it years ago.
It's not just collecting info. I mean, there's been story after story about inappropriate videos showing up in recommendations and then, you know, pedophiles using like coded messages and comments to, and I mean, YouTube, I think, has admitted, I don't know if they have or not, that nobody goes to YouTube Kids.
Right.
If they, unless their parents force them to, I guess.
So this was in the Wall Street, in the Wall Street Journal last week, but according to the Post, a person close to the company said that that option's highly improbable. Difficult to implement because of the sheer volume of content and potentially costly because of lost advertising revenues. Well, yeah, because you're not supposed to advertise to them anyway.
Well, that's the point.
That's the point. But the person close to the company said that other changes were on the table. YouTube Kids gets a tiny fraction of YouTube's audience.
Could we go to the other end of this for a second? Yeah. I'll ruin every conversation.
YouTube, but, is there going to be YouTube olds for the olds? Because I would like that.
Full of conspiracy theories?
Yeah.
And keto diet tips?
Yeah. It's called double ARP tube. Okay, go ahead, Jeff. Seriously.
So a lot of this is going to go to identity, provable identity. Yeah. And so two threads to this, right? In the UK, they're about to implement a law requiring you to have a certified identity to see porn.
They put that in the back burner.
Oh, okay. Oh, they did.
Yeah,
okay.
They did. It came out because they didn't tell the EU.
Well, that'll soon not matter.
Yeah. We just thought we wouldn't be part of the EU by now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you look at the Libra story. What fascinating, the story you guys put up there about how the hidden interesting thing in the Libra announcement was a new structure of verifiable identity, which sounds interesting, but also sounds in certain regimes dangerous. And, you know, will you have to verify your identity and thus your age before you can get into YouTube or an email address or all of that?
This is the MIT Technology Review, Mike Orcutt. The radical idea hiding inside Facebook's digital currency proposal. That's an interesting point. I mean, that actually goes to the question about the blockchain, because the blockchain is the record of transactions. And in Facebook's proposal with LibraCoin, the blockchain is not a public ledger, but is managed by these initial companies, 100 strong or whatever, these that are part of it. They're going to be the nodes, and they're going to manage the blockchain. So it isn't a completely decentralized cryptocurrency. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah. And there's a reason for that. If you are completely decentralized, transactions take forever. And that's been the problem on Bitcoin. The Facebook coin supposedly will be able to handle 1,000 transactions a second because it is not fully decentralized. But that's still a tiny fraction for 1 billion or 2 billion users. 1,000 transactions a second is not going to make it. So I don't know. I wonder about how this is going to work.
It is interesting, though. You remember the years ago when open identity standards were, you know, Google was working on one, and there was going to be there was a consortium of groups that were trying to come up with a sort of a way of logging into things without requiring you to use Facebook or Twitter or any other thing, and none of them went anywhere, and it was because they couldn't get enough agreement from the places that would then use that standard.
Right.
Not that the standards themselves weren't good, just that it was hard to get kind of buy-in.
That is the problem with standards.
Bitcoin can process about 5 transactions a second. That's very, very slow. Visa does
24,000.
Visa does 1,700 transactions a second on average. And I'm sure it peaks at much higher numbers. So if LibraCoin does half what Visa has to do, it's not going to be. It's a non-starter, right?
I thought Visa did many more.
Visa says we do 150 million transactions a day. Divide that by 20.
If each one were a penny, how long? No, sorry.
It would cover the world, my friend. Cover the world. Visa is capable of, this is where that number comes from, Stacey, of 24,000 per second. So that's the peak speed. That's a lot more. That's 24 times LibraCoin. I wonder, now that I'm thinking about it, what is the point of LibraCoin? Maybe it is this authentication.
It's not designed to replace Visa, I don't think. It's not designed to replace every transaction.
But Visa's just one credit card. Yeah. I mean, it's not every transaction even.
Well, we buy a lot of stuff.
They're a big one, but I'm just saying there's also MasterCard. There's also American Express. There's also Discover Card. There's also cash. There's also checks. If you really wanted to cover the financial world, 1,000 transactions a second is not even close.
Well, they don't want to cover the financial world. I think they want to cover peer-to-peer kind of quick payments.
Like Venmo.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think like Venmo or, you know, like in China, how everybody can like take a picture of, scan a QR code, and boom, they've paid for something.
Right.
I wish we had that.
Oh.
I'm not going to lie.
You may get it.
Someone I wish we had it in a way like
who would
someone
you
said this was more like Western Union than a cryptocurrency.
Okay. Who would you prefer, Stacey?
I would trust Amazon to do it. I would Amazon? Actually trust my banks to do it.
Apple
Square.
Will probably do it. Apple's got a credit card. They're on their way.
I don't like Apple. Their ecosystem's too insular for me. Okay.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
Sorry. I'm like, not
Amazon
not
you would trust.
Yeah, I would.
I do nothing. Because I know what Amazon's agenda and goals are. They want me to buy a bunch of stuff from them.
Right.
So I feel like, and my data, when it goes into Amazon, it doesn't go out of Amazon. Amazon keeps that. They make stupid choices when they buy companies like Ring and they're stupid. But Amazon locks that stuff down because they don't want to give the advantage to other people. And the advantage to them is Stacey will stay in our world and will buy a crap ton of stuff from
us. But not to raise a straw man, but let me raise a straw man.
Okay.
Right
Bring
now,
me your straw man.
Right now, Amazon's goal is
what
to.
What about a straw woman?
Okay, a straw person. Let's raise a straw person, or, as they say, a paper tiger. Amazon right now wants to just sell you stuff. What if at some point Amazon had other goals?
So that is a question. Like with the Amazon's health insurance or health efforts, I'm like, well, what could that look like? That kind of makes me a little nervous. At some point in time, I would want to make sure my eggs are not all in the Amazon basket. And if that wasn't an option, then I would cry foul.
Isn't that the best way to avoid all of this is to spread yourself out?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not to be...
It's a lot of work, though.
You know, yeah.
People, it's, I think,
It's sure easier if you're all Apple, right? Yeah. If everything you have is Apple, everything works together.
And it
Stacey
works.
And IoT, yeah. Isn't it all better if it's all HomeKit or all smart things or all?
Oh, it works better, sure.
Yeah. That's why these companies try to do this. You know, the one of the companies that's not doing that, there's two, Microsoft and Google, actually don't really care. Google gets
Google with their Nest thing just kind of changed that. But
okay.
So the Nest thing is different.
That was a little different. Okay, I'm going to pause for a second. Without ads, I have to go run and get a cup of coffee.
Coffee while I talk about how Verizon.
I'd love.
Oh, yeah. Get one for Matthew, too.
Did you get? Yeah. An espresso. Thanks.
Honestly, if you're going to do this show, you ought to have a couple of things in the studio with you. A coffee maker, a beverage machine, and perhaps a toilet. Because these shows go on and on and on. We're almost done.
Without an ad,
there is no break. Wait a minute, I got an ad. Don't we have a house ad that we're all supposed to be doing here? Can you get me a house ad?
Okay, I came back.
And now, a house ad. Wait a minute, no, it's better than that. It's subtler.
Correct.
We truly appreciate you listening to this podcast. Every day, it takes a team of hosts, producers, editors, engineers, and support staff, not to mention the person who gets Leo's dry cleaning, to get our content to you. As you know, our podcasts are free. You didn't pay anything for
Patreon,
this, did you?
This is a Patreon pitch starting here?
No. Free, and ad supported.
Beer,
the easiest thing you can do to help our network, besides sending us cash, no surveys, to subscribe. It's that easy. Subscribe to it, this show, and all your favorite Twit podcasts, because that way you'll get it instantly when it's available. And it helps us in some magical way I've never really understood. But I believe Lisa when she says it. And she gets the dry cleaning, so it's okay. Thanks for listening. And remember to subscribe on your favorite podcatcher, or just go to twit.tv/subscribe, and we'll tell you.
And send a nice tip to Lisa.
And thank Lisa and all those people who make actually, there are a lot of people. It takes about.
I was about to say, they're nice
one,
people,
two,
too.
Three. They're really nice people. They deserve your support. And of course, let's not forget Stacy, Jeff, and Matthew. They all count. So this was wild. On the 24th of June, 2 days ago, I started seeing tweets that Cloudflare was gone down, and I thought, oh, my God, Cloudflare, that can't go down. Cloudflare provides DDoS protection and uptime protection for much of the Internet. And Cloudflare had a post on this, and it turns out it was Verizon's fault.
It was somebody else's fault, but Verizon was like, they certified it. Basically, it was...
So essentially what happened is there's a border gateway protocol, BGP routers, where you essentially broadcast the Internet, an Internet route to the world. Normally, if it's done properly, you broadcast a route that is just for traffic to you, and you say, here's how traffic gets to me or to the people I serve. Unfortunately, a small steel company in Allegheny, Pennsylvania... Allegheny Technologies Incorporated. Now, I'm not sure who specified these routes, but these routes were broadcast that all the Internet should go through Allegheny Technologies in Pennsylvania.
How do they do that?
This is a known massive problem, frankly, with the way the Internet works. This has been happening.
This has happened a couple times.
For decades.
Didn't Poland recently, a year ago, Poland did it? Yeah.
There are protections that could be introduced to prevent it. Verizon does not. One of the protections would of course be to notice if a massive amount of traffic was coming through your network.
Going through a single route.
About 15% of Cloudflare, because Cloudflare was on this route, Cloudflare's traffic got routed instead of going to where it was supposed to go, got routed to the leaky BGP process on Verizon and then went to Allegheny Technologies.
So did Allegheny do this? Did they reconfigure something?
I think it's Verizon.
They did. So Allegheny made the original mistake.
Oh, okay.
But what happened is they sent their original mistake up to Verizon, and Verizon
rubber stamped it.
Right, which would presumably be better at this than Allegheny.
Yeah, although Allegheny is an internet service provider.
Don't Russians do this all the time?
Yeah, it'd be a good way to take down the net. Well, because unlike Verizon,
most people catch it.
Most of these people have. By the way, the stunning thing is Cloudflare tried to reach Verizon, and they have pictures in their blog post of all of the emails, all of the pager duties, all of the calls. Verizon, I guess, a little too busy to respond. Route leak from your customer, all of this stuff. So what Cloudflare says is Verizon and everybody who does this kind of thing should be implementing a framework they call RPKI, which is, it's very simple. If a BGP session could be configured with a hard limit of prefixes to be received, if all of a sudden the entire internet comes a-knocking, you should shut that route down. Cloudflare writes, had Verizon had such a prefix limit in place, this would not have occurred. It is a best practice to have such limits in place. It doesn't cost a provider anything. And this is my favorite line in this blog post. And there's no good reason other than sloppiness or laziness that Verizon wouldn't have such limits in place.
Ding. Possibly both.
Or both. And there's also a filtering system that you could use.
Greed.
Well, it's not even greed.
It's not greed. I think the challenge here, or a challenge here, is Cloudflare had the luxury of building up their infrastructure. Cloudflare literally designed its own servers, right? This is a true cloudy internet company, whereas Verizon's a telco that has all this old line infrastructure.
And they make so little money.
Their mindset is not, it's not proactive or even, they're not seeking to optimize the way internet companies are, because they don't have to until stuff like this happens. It's hubris. But it's ingrained into their culture.
That was even possible. That's a shock to me.
But
the internet is very...
It's surprisingly fragile, to be honest.
Just a series of tubes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what a story, though. I mean, just what a wild story. It was 3 hours before DQE fixed the problem. Verizon,
and I remember reading about the Cloudflare problems, but I didn't look into what happened.
Yeah.
I don't understand RPKI, so I'm like... I really want to dig into this a little bit more.
We're big fans of Cloudflare. They've been.
If you could learn about it and then tell us about it, that would be great.
Yeah.
I mean, Cloudflare to me is one of those companies like Amazon that when you talk to them, they see the way the internet is growing and changing, and they're trying to solve problems that are going to appear 3 to 4 years out. Right. So I always love talking to them.
They say AT&T have already enabled this successfully on their network, so they're not going to be the next one to do this. And I think there's a little pressure probably on Verizon to do it. It basically filters the origin network and prefix size. So if you advertise a sanity check on the route that you're advertising. If you're advertising a nonsense route, it'll be blocked or stopped. You know, no, this isn't going to happen. So that's a simple way to. There's actually many simple ways to do this. The fact that Verizon didn't is kind of shocking.
How long was it out?
3 hours. Not
same,
completely
same as
out.
Google Calendar.
Yeah. Now we don't know what happened with Google Calendar, but that was
lovely.
Did people really not go to work because their calendar didn't tell them they had to? Because that was the story.
They didn't know how to do conference calls because all the conference call data was in the calendar.
Well, that's true. That's where I put
meetings.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I put it in the calendar.
But here's the other thing that broke. Far more important than all of this.
What?
Far more irritating.
What?
Autocomplete in Chrome is borked.
I did not notice, but wow.
So if I start typing WA, it goes WashingtonPost.com and I go there, right?
Yeah.
Now I have to type out WashingtonPost. Before I get the
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Okay, so I'm doing it right now. WA, you're right, doesn't do it. S does, but that's because I've been to the Washington Post recently, maybe.
They put out a fix that I don't think I have in Chrome OS yet.
Jarvis is
autocomplete for domains.
For domains.
Hey, 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 hey.
You know what?
No, it's autocomplete for domains. It's the problem.
By the way, they fixed that so you can't type it. Let me see. Leo Laporte is a... Used to be able to type that, right? And find out.
Right.
And they've stopped it.
Oh, just what? For people.
Wait a minute. Did
everything.
You see how fast
right
that
there.
Happened?
Right
they
there.
Showed it and then,
wow.
Whoa. No, well, we're not going to show you that.
They removed it.
Whoa, whoa. That's pretty funny. So there's something going on there. Let's see. Stacy. I should.
But it's domains.
Yeah, no, domain completion. Yeah.
But now yes. Leo's having fun.
Well, I'm having too much
right.
fun.
Okay.
So I don't
now
really
we're,
care.
Yeah.
So it takes three letters for me. Three or four letters.
I think you have the fix. I can't do that still.
Okay.
You should try these things called bookmarks. You just click on them.
Oh, I have 15 years of bookmark mess.
Oh, I just deleted my bookmarks gosh. Today. It was so
wait a minute.
Happy.
Nice. Why did you delete nice. Your bookmarks?
Well, like I went. Kondo. Sorry, I cleaned up my bookmarks. Oh. Yeah, so now I only have six
you.
Bookmarks.
What?
I'm a Kondo fanatic.
Yeah,
I know.
I have seven. Absolutely.
You want to see how cray-cray my bookmarks are? This is my news folder. This is my Leo folder. This is my social There's just... This is my favorite one, programming.
Oh,
within programming, there is many folders, a folder per language with many links within each language. Go, 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 baby. This is a... What's wrong with this? What is that? What is wrong with... This is my Lisp folder. That's nothing wrong with that. That doesn't occupy any space. It's just a little folder there.
What's I know. Wrong? It's just, I mean, the point of bookmarks is to get to something quickly. So if it's cluttered, you can't get to it quickly.
Well, it's not cluttered. See, my toolbar, I don't even go to it. Do you just use a toolbar? Folders is a secret.
Yeah. I just use a toolbar.
Yeah. Folders.
Well, I use both. I have a folder for recipes, but that's about it.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. I should probably look into that.
Bookmarks are, nope. are a resource.
Nothing. I just search.
I know. I don't.
If I can remember two words about it, I just search.
Yeah, that's true. That's me.
That's a good point.
I know. Josh I trust. Benton. I. Who's Josh Benton?
What about him?
Josh Benton is
the Neiman Journalism Lab.
Neiman Lab.
Oh yeah.
And he talks about how he literally has 500 tabs in the Chrome browser.
I've never understood
so
that.
So Mike Masnick at Techter, I think, is in the 400 to 500 range at all times.
Wow.
So he must have 100 gigs 20. Of RAM. I don't know how.
Yeah, because every tab in Google is in Chrome is like
it's its own process.
Yeah. People joke that's why Apple made a new computer with 1.4 terabytes of RAM so you could have all
so
your,
you could run Chrome.
You could have all your tabs open. I've never been a tab person. I close tabs when I'm done with them.
Oh my gosh. Right now I'm good. I only have 12 open.
So you really shouldn't be crowing about your bookmark hygiene. Instead of bookmarking stuff, you just leave the tab open.
Well, no, I shut them down at the end of the day.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you do? I leave them all open.
Yeah. Well, I leave. Okay. That's not true. I shouldn't say that. I shut most of them down. I will only leave like two or three in addition to email overnight.
The only time I shut down a tab is when it's auto playing video. With the audio.
Every time you close a tab, an angel gets its wings.
I believe that. Yes.
Just remember that.
640K of RAM should be plenty.
anything else you guys want to talk about? Because I'm talked out here. Anything?
Do we want to talk about Sidewalk Labs or no?
Yeah. You were interested about this. Yeah. So this is actually in Toronto. This is in Toronto. They want to build a smart city in the old railroad yards, right? Or something like that.
It's down by the port. Docks.
It's on the quay. The quay.
It's a port.
What is that called? Quayside?
Quayside.
Yeah, it's Quayside. Quay with a
key. These whiny Canadians don't know how good they're getting.
Actually, I like Quayside, Toronto. I think that's kind of a neat area. Is that where you get the area. That's where
Google
you get the boat to the airport, right?
No. But you used to be able to get a boat to Rochester, but nobody wanted to go there. So.
Okay. So Sidewalk Labs, which is a Google thing, and Toronto, Waterfront Toronto, announced a plan to take this area and redevelop it, but make it a smart city, which did, of course, stimulate some protest because the smart city meant it would gather data about you, about traffic, about where people go.
Well, no, what generated the protest wasn't that. It was that basically the there's a separate development corporation that was formed to work with Google or work with Sidewalk Labs on this. So Sidewalk Labs, an Alphabet company, just like Google is. And they basically came up with a plan, and they had no actual input from any of the citizenry who was going to live there. And so the protests, I think, were actually very legit in the sense that, wait, why are you, what is happening here? We live here and you're doing this deal with Google and you're treating it like a real estate deal, but it's really going to put a lot of sensors in and gather all this data.
No, wait a minute. Nobody lives there, right?
Nobody lives there yet.
Well, nobody lives there yet.
Well, and if you don't want to live there, there's a place down the road you could live.
Well, but there's also, I mean, there's going to be businesses located there. I mean,
only by choice.
But the principle is still, the principle was who controls the data. Is it Google? Does Google get access to that data? Does the province get access to that data? Does the federal government get access to that data? Do other companies get access to that data? And it's not clear. So all the benefits are clear. Everything would run perfectly, and you know, you'd have hot and cold running everything, and automated cars, and
And if you don't like it, don't live there.
Right, but then the data on your usage, which Google says it would use to make things better, who controls it? Who owns it? Who gets to give it to others or
honestly,
use it in different ways?
Given the choice between the province and Google, I think I'd choose Google. Look what the CBP, the Customs and Border Protection.
Of this province is right now. It's Ford. He's a nut job.
Fair. So that's fair. But
I don't trust the province as far as I can throw it. Google at least has
a democratic process, and you can change the rules associated with it. And Google isn't a democratic process. And remember what we talked about with ambient privacy, and it's easy to say, don't go there. But it's hard to say that if a government office is based there, or maybe they put a school there, or your kid's daycare is there. I mean,
but you're the one who said you should judge the outcome by who profits, what the business motive is. And
I said that you should judge it based on the outcome and how it affects how it affects people.
Yeah,
and
because you can understand
how it affects people who don't have power.
Oh, okay. Maybe it wasn't you who said it, but somebody said that the best way to judge whether your data was safe with the company is what the company's profit, you know.
Oh, that's what I said about Amazon. Yes, yeah. I understand its profit motive. Amazon's not collecting my data outside. Amazon's collecting my data when I interact with it. This is a different level of interaction. This is walking down a city street or
somebody look at whether it's, I mean, even if you're not in Quayside, somebody's collecting the province is collecting your data all the time. They've got cameras everywhere. They're collecting your data all the time.
But they usually have rules associated with how that data gets seen.
Well, but my point being that A, they may have rules which change all the time depending on who gets elected and who's corrupt. And B, they don't have any security policy. Look what happened to the Customs and Border Protection. Hackers stole license plate images, travelers' IDs, and now as we learn more.
So they stole that, though, from a third party.
From a provider.
Right. A third party that had the data because CPB let them have the data.
Right, but that Sony was victim of a similar hack.
No, I understand. I'm just saying, who you trust with your data, Google or the province of Ontario?
So that's a fair point. I mean, it's not as though there's an easy answer. But
I think Google knows more about security than Mr. Ford.
You know what the easy answer is?
What?
Toronto, if you want to whine about it, fine. Google, go to Newark, New Jersey. They could use this. Yeah. Toronto's in great shape. Real estate costs are insane. Go to a city that, same with Amazon and their damned headquarters. Go to Newark, New Jersey. Go to a place that needs it.
Nobody wants those people's data.
Yeah.
That's kind of where, that's the problem.
That's harsh, but true.
It is. I mean, you know, could Camden benefit from better traffic management or safer policing tactics?
Hell yeah.
To me, there's a happy medium there somewhere where Google agrees to share data, and there's a sort of arm's length entity that includes Google but also includes the province. I mean, this is not an unsolvable problem, and I think you probably You could learn a lot from that city, from people's behavior. You could learn things that would improve other cities, that would make things easier, that would.
And they've created a third party to deal with. I can't think of the name of it right now. What is it called? Hold on. The Urban Data Trust. I think the issue, one of the issues in the plan that they released, though, was it's still not clear who's in the Urban Data Trust, what they, how they can protect the public's interest in elements associated with that. Though,
like a lot of this has come only with people pushing Google. Only with, you know, the former privacy commissioner resigning and saying this is not a workable model. And I think Google, in the same way they and a lot of other companies do, they thought, hey, we're going to give you a bunch of free stuff for your city. You should be thanking us. You know, it's obviously going to be good because we're Google and we're great. Instead of kind of trying to meet some of these questions head on, they had to be dragged into it.
You know, in 1994, Walt Disney, the company, not the person, built a town in Florida called Celebration, a planned community.
Lovely.
By the way, it's 88% white in an area where it's only 59% white. But there, so there are other issues. There are people who don't like the fact that everything's planned down to the manhole covers. But there are people who are very happy to live there. And then there are some people who say it's kind of creepy, but honestly,
it's the good place.
It's the good place is exactly what it is. I imagine Disney got a lot of information about people who lived there and all that, right?
I don't know. I mean, they built that in 1947, 49?
No, 94.
Long after that.
Yeah.
94. Okay. Oh, I know their hospital.
Collecting data.
Yeah.
So, it's not...
Why is there a sheriff's line there in the picture?
It was a crime scene of the first ever murder.
Oh, that too, yeah. Well, but the houses are falling apart.
This was the first ever murder 14 years after it was built.
Who did this story? This is interesting.
Yeah, this is Gizmodo.
Apparently it was very poor craftsmanship. All the builders were underqualified. And,
yeah. But in other words, it's not... And I mean, Levittown.
Yeah.
It's not a new idea to have a planned community, and I think there are a lot of people who think, oh, that's a great idea. And if you have digital technology and you could plan traffic and other things using digital technology, I don't know if that's such a terrible idea. And
Don Mills was even one of just, the first,
and who cares if Google knows where the traffic goes?
Oh, there's a lot of information that can be gleaned from traffic, as we've figured
but
out.
Is Google keeping track of when you Google poop?
Yeah, they would know when they left your house. They would know when you got into a cab.
They know right now when I leave my house. And I'm not even in a planned community.
Right, but they know that. So they know that now, but if you were an Apple phone user, you might say, okay, well.
I have a way of not having them know, but not living in Quayside, Toronto.
But I still think it would be, you're right, people don't have to choose to live there if they don't want to. But I still think it would be useful to have some kind of
assurances about process, who gets access
to the data. Assurances about who gets access to the data, what data they get to access. I'd like to have that from Facebook. I'd like to have it from lots of companies. So I would like to have it from Google. If they are running
would be sad if because of some imagine, and this is more like
here,
Jeff's
look at it,
argument.
Look at it this way. Actually, this will appeal to you, Jeff, because you're a journalist. If I have questions about things in my city today, I can go to a city council, I can file a FOIA request, and I can get whatever data exists, right? It's a pain, but I can do it. If Google has that data, and this is a quasi-government whatever project, then if I want to find out information about, you know, maybe I notice that there are no people of color in this place. Maybe I notice, I don't know, that the toilets back up a whole lot. I can't get any information necessarily about that. Yeah. So there are reasons to wonder about public access to what is effectively city data.
So I think it's a very good point, Stacey. Excellent point. But I think there are some other analogs you can go to, which is condominiums.
Yeah.
Right?
HOAs, homeowners agreements. Can be very onerous.
Yeah, co-ops are the ultimate capitalistic society where there's only one value, that's property.
Right.
In New York. And so there are some analogs there where it's quasi-public. So what happens is you have separate, if you look at that as an analog, you have separate regulation in the government about how apartments are run, right? Whether you're a landlord or whether you're a co-op or a condo, you can impose things externally, which is what government's trying to do.
You're basically creating, right? If you were in Oryx and Crake, you're basically creating those company-based communities that where the companies control, it becomes truly a network of company towns, which
exists to some extent today.
I don't think it exists.
My wife and I would move to a planned community next to us because they said you couldn't put up a flagpole. We had no desire to put up a flagpole, but we resented the idea that somebody was going to tell us you can't put up a flagpole or paint your door red or whatever.
But what if over time, this is well beyond a condo.
Like this is well
yeah,
beyond.
And over time, this is going to be better services.
Yeah. What I'm saying is there's precedent about how to deal with these questions with things like condos. So what I'm saying is the role here, I think, should be the government should it's regulation. And Canadians love regulation. They should say, rather than expecting Google or the private company to do it, government should be the one that insists upon it. And they're going to do the permits. Just like government can say you have to build so many schools or you've got to make the roads this big. That's government's job.
Yeah.
And I think we're just negotiating how that happens.
That's right. Good.
Like, I don't think it's
a negotiation.
Right.
As long as I just don't want to see.
Give you a bunch of land.
They don't need you. Come to Newark. Come to Newark. I'll move in. You come to Newark, I'll move in.
I'll tell you what. Newark looks
way better. That is not a selling
point. Newark looks way better than the Portside lands. So.
Does Canada have a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act?
We do.
The equivalent? Yeah.
What
we may not in the United States. The Supreme Court two days ago, expanded.
Yeah, I saw that decision.
Yeah, in the Argus Leader case.
So companies, if it involves a company, it can now be determined to be confidential.
Private. Yeah. Private. It was the...
That's a horrible, horrible...
Yeah, Food Marketing Institute versus Argus Leader Media. The Supreme Court ruled that... Argus Leader Media does not have the right to that information because they were doing a FOIA with the U.S. Department of Agriculture seeking the names and addresses of all retail stores that participate in the food stamp program, SNAP, and each store's annual SNAP redemption data. This would be, of course, from a journalist's point of view, some very interesting data. USDA said no. Argus Leader sued. The Supreme Court said it's commercial information and can be kept confidential because it comes from companies. So they didn't say
that those companies have to meet any test where they say it's confidential because, or if we release it, X bad thing is going to happen. It's just ipso facto, everything is considered confidential.
Right.
The Institute has standing to appeal. The disclosure of the contested data would cause its members financial injury in the highly competitive grocery industry. This concrete injury is directly traceable to the judgment ordering disclosure. And
Argus won all the way up to the Supreme Court. Like, it won every decision, obviously. But it's interesting to read the dissent. It's quite scathing.
Yeah, because it undermines FOIA.
I think it's who's on which side.
I can't remember who delivered the
it's right
dissent.
Let me look at SCOTUS blog here. An opinion by Justice Neil Gorsuch for a 6-justice majority. Justice Elena Kagan. Elena Kagan was on the majority. Let me see who wrote the dissent. Anyway, that's an interesting... some say this might undermine FOIA.
It's a bad decision.
Yeah.
It's a bad decision.
Yeah. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Justice Stephen Breyer, partial dissent.
Weird mixes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... But I think weird mixes are good. At least it's not along, you know, kind of party lines here, right?
Still a bad decision.
Yeah. Well... FOIA is a great thing. The Freedom of Information Act has proven to be a very powerful tool for journalists and for the public.
This is going
to
cut its legs
off. Amen.
Yeah.
Not just journalists. I mean, normal citizens. Parents use it a lot to figure out.
Activists.
Right. Yeah.
I want to retract many of the conversations we've had over the past few years about the distinction between a platform and a publisher. Oh. This has to do with Section 230. All right, your ach can come in a moment. Mike Masnick, who we do like a lot, he's with TechDirt.
He's the best.
He said, I'm going to say it again, there's no legal distinction between a platform and a publisher. Everybody, the way that the Section 230 is written is that everybody, is an internet platform. If you're online, you're an internet platform and you're protected. That companies don't need to worry about whether they're a publisher or a platform. If they're online, they're protected. You disagree, Jeff?
In regards to 230, I agree. But that's why I hate that being the test, because there's a lot else that falls into place there.
Ah, okay.
But in regards to 230, it's about enabling conversation, and many parties do that. And as
230 protects,
the authors of the bill said, all, they give a shield and a sword.
Right. 230 protects all, quote, interactive computer services, including publishers who host third-party content. You don't have to say, you don't have to figure out, you don't have to be as Facebook, you know, I have said mistakenly, oh, Facebook's got to figure out as a platform or a publisher. No, it's an internet company.
In regards to 230, no.
Okay.
Right.
Where does it matter?
That's the point. You're not considered a publisher just because, yeah, it's, by the way, I'm going to plug it again. Everybody out there, read Jeff Kossoff's book, The 26 Words That Created the Internet. Mm-hmm. It's an excellent biography of the law and where it stands.
And I imagine that he delves into this there.
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah. It's really, you ought to have him on the show. It's okay. Really good.
Okay. So I have.
And in fact, the whole point of the law was to make it so that interactive service providers could delete content and curate do all those other things without being subject to different rules.
It wouldn't be a slippery slope. They have the safe harbor protection of Section 230, regardless of what they do to the content that they're publishing, whether they edit it or
just be a pipe,
right?
That distributes without it.
Highly recommend. Have you read the book, Matthew?
No, I have. It's on my list.
Highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. It's because it's the fight that we're going into, right? So you see that effort from the right last week to say that if you're not neutral, you're going to lose 230 protection.
Right.
You shouldn't have it. Yeah. There's going to be efforts to knock down pieces of 230. And Wyden, who is the co-author with Roth, Wyden in the Senate, Roth in the House when he was there. Not Roth. No. Somebody else. But Wyden in the Senate. And Wyden's very unhappy that the platforms didn't stand up to protect 230 in, what was it called,
FOSTA SESTA.
Because the fear is there's going to be a lot more carve-outs of 230. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And there was
testimony
this week arguing that there ought to be an additional phrase there that it's extended to those that do responsible moderation. But then, you know, if I want to be 8chan and everything goes away after 30 seconds or whatever, however long it is, it goes away. You know, that's a choice on the internet. Why should that be considered
bad? One thing Mike points out, which I think is really important, is he points out that this doesn't just protect Google and Facebook. It protects newspapers that have comment sections. It protects any publisher. It protects review sites. It protects literally anybody who, you know, offers a service where people comment. So it's not just that it protects these giant platforms that get away with whatever you think they're getting away with. It protects anyone who's offering a service where people are expressing their opinions.
When The Guardian started Comment is Free a little many years ago, their really robust discussion platform, which was groundbreaking at the time, it was really gutsy because there's no 230 nor a First Amendment, of course, in the UK, and they were liable for things said on the platform. And they, against the advice of a lot of people in media, went ahead and did it, but most people in media didn't want to be anywhere near it because they would have liability.
We went through that, the newspaper I worked at, when I was involved in comments and social media. It was a huge Because there's no Section 30 and 230 in Canada either.
Oh, that's interesting. So what's it like with the no Section 230?
Well, everyone is very, very nervous.
Yeah, all the time.
Especially lawyers. Because you just never know. There have been a couple of decisions. I remember taking part in a case involving comments, and there have been a couple of decisions, lower courts, that did uphold the right of publishers to moderate comments and said that that didn't, by definition, sort of lay them open to lawsuits. So it wasn't as though you have to keep your hands off or you won't be covered. But it's still a very gray area.
It's very cool that we have this Section 230. This is part of
it. We got to fight for it. We got to defend it.
Yeah, we got to defend it. And
it's the last smart thing Congress did.
It was 1996. Really, it's been that long, huh?
It was when it was. You think about how early it was in the process of the internet starting. It was very prescient to realize the principle of, and this goes to James Carey, the principle of defending conversation in a democracy.
Yeah.
And I guarantee nothing like that would ever be passed now.
Oh, God, no.
Not in a million years.
Well, and that's why it's under assault. I just ordered the book.
Libraries, if you tried to create a library now, if there weren't libraries,
right,
and you said, we're going to have a bunch of books, we're going to give them away to anybody who wants them, it would never happen. No one would ever allow you to create a library.
You're a socialist.
You're going to give away
books. So in Kossoff's book, there was a case of a bookstore that had literature viewed as pornographic, and the argument was the bookstore owner was responsible. But the contrary argument was the bookstore owner doesn't read everything in the bookstore.
Right.
And therein, that debate leads you to 230. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that there's a debate about, do you remember the Media Men list?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Google Doc that went around.
Yeah, it was a list of Me Too, people accused of Me Too.
Right. So someone has sued over being named in that list.
Oh, really?
And the creator of the list is trying to argue that that Google document was effectively an interactive service. And therefore, she shouldn't be responsible for things that were contributed to that list because they were contributed by. Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I mean, is she the creator? Like, everyone else added things to that document. It was effectively an interactive document.
Right.
Anyway, interesting case.
Jeff K-O-S-S. Jeff K-O-S-S-E-F-F, the 26 words that created the internet, if you want to follow up. Mm-hmm. I just ordered it. I'm gonna read it. I think I need to.
There was a case in Australia on the rundown today of a woman who lost $500,000 case from a plastic surgeon she had libeled, defamed, in a Google review about her cheek reduction. Right. Now, right, that stopped me right there. A cheek reduction.
Well, if you had big cheeks, if you were one of us,
lots of people,
one of the sufferers, one of us who suffer from big cheek syndrome or BCS, yes, you would not make light.
Jeff does not have big cheeks.
Of this, no, he's a scrawny little cuss.
Oh, God, no.
But
anyway.
Old Moonface Leo, I know how she feels.
You got to reduce your cheeks, Chipmunk, there?
Yeah, I'm thinking. But I'm not going to this plastic surgeon, I can tell you. I read the review.
The plastic surgeon won.
He won. See, that's shocking to me. If you can't...
Well, no, because it was demonstrably false.
Oh, she lied about it. Oh.
She lied about it.
Oh, yes. Well, that's different.
It was a false review, and so people think on the internet, oh, I can just put this stuff up. No, libel law pertains.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a good outcome.
Just like if I said something slanderous... Slander would still pertain.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, I'm a journalist, so it's Twitter, a little different.
Twitter has been involved in a bunch of cases like that. I think, didn't Courtney Love was sued for defaming somebody on Twitter?
But in this case, Yelp wouldn't be liable. Twitter wouldn't be liable.
Twitter was not liable. Exactly.
No, but the person who posted it might be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. That makes sense. And that probably is the answer to that spreadsheet that was going around is that, well, the person who created the spreadsheet might not be liable, but whoever put
people who contributed
libelous statements in it would be liable. Flyaway, libel, L-I-B-E-L versus L-I-A-B-L-E. I should pronounce those differently.
You should be liable for your libel.
Liable. Don't lie.
Oh, the other book, Dreyer's English. Dreyer's English. Have you read that one?
No. Oh, man.
The copy chief of Random House. It's delightful. It is, believe it or not, it's a book about copy editing, and it's delightful.
I love that kind of stuff. Yep. That one I might buy in hardcover. Benjamin Dreyer.
Oxford comma. Yeah.
Yeah, right on, dude. And we've had this
you
battle
also
before.
Read Eats, Shoots, and Leaves.
Yes, that's an Oxford.
I have that.
Yeah, great book.
Actually, I think
I have tons of grammar books, actually.
Stacy might have written this one. Miss Thistlebottom's Hobgoblins. Careful Writer's Guide to Taboos, Bugbears, and Outmoded Rules of English.
Thistlebottom are cousins, I think.
Stacy Thistlebottom. Yeah.
That is my British cousin right there.
Cousins from the north.
Are we actually doing our picks?
Yes.
I don't know what to do now that we're like.
Give us a pick.
The show goes on.
Give us
forever.
A pick. Thistlebottom.
Tell us about the Thistlebottoms first, though.
All right. Well, my pick is not a tech pick because I bought the most ingenious thing that I love, and I must share it with you.
Okay.
It is the OXO Good Grips salad dressing shaker.
I love everything OXO Good Grips does.
So what now?
I didn't know they made this, but like I just have been shaking up my dressings in an old dressing jar. But when we moved, I didn't have a mason jar and I didn't have a cup or anything. So I just bought this because I was like, I might use this. Oh my gosh, it's awesome. And if you want to make it even better for people, if there's like one or two dressings that you guys normally make all the time in your house, take a Sharpie and write the amounts on the dressing, make the dressing and write like oil to this point.
Oh, that's a good idea because anybody can make it.
Then anyone can use it, but it doesn't leak. You can use it to shake stuff up. It's very easy to clean.
Right now.
Nice.
So,
because I bought a 6-pack of squeeze bottles, you know, like the mustard and ketchup bottles.
Yes. Because somebody told me to do that and it was a great idea.
Yeah.
We bought some too.
Yeah, and so I make my dressing and put it in there. But this would be better because you have to put your finger over the hole when you're shaking it. So this would be better.
We use the ketchup bottles, the squeezable bottles for barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
That we make.
Yeah. I keep a bottle of olive oil by the stove all the time. That's really the best use because then you can always squirt a little olive oil in a pan or whatever, and it's very fast and easy.
Yeah, and this comes in two sizes: a 1.5 cup or a 1 cup.
I would get anything by Bluetooth.
There is nothing smart unless you do your little dressing recipes on it. Then it's smart. Oh, mine's green. I don't know why yours is black, but there you go.
There you go.
You should get one in each color, and that way
you can make martinis in it if you wanted to.
Yes, you totally could. That is a great option. There you go.
They don't have large and green here.
Maybe what?
Well, maybe that's because I'm on the wrong page. There you go.
I don't know. But I love this thing. I've only had it for 4 weeks now. But, man, I have washed it. I've used it. It has a gasket. So when you put it in the fridge, it doesn't smell up the place.
Nice.
So, it's good. So, I have not found a problem with it yet.
And you can also get the 2-in-1 dressing shaker with a citrus juicer on top of it.
Yeah, that seemed like a lot of.
Yeah,
overkill. That seemed like more.
Yeah, but too much.
But if you want, let me know how that works.
I'm buying this. This is awesome.
Yeah, I was really. I didn't even know these existed. I was very excited.
I should just take it. One of everything OXO does.
Oh wait, though. Oh, what? I should tell you before you buy it. I bought mine for $9.99 at Target. And this is like $15.
This seems like they're. You know what? This is one of those guys who goes to Target, buys 100 of them, and sells them on Amazon for $5 more. Guaranteed.
Right. Yeah. So that's my only caveat. But, I liked it.
Nice. Good pick. Any cooking pick is okay with me. Oh, now that I've gone to the one that's more expensive, I swear to God.
I'll show you the cheaper one.
I swear to God, Amazon has raised the price on the one that was $9, is now also $15.
Because it was tired of you being indecisive.
I swear to God, wasn't this? Am I wrong, folks? Wasn't this $9? And now it's
$15.
Jeez, Amazon's algorithmic pricing at work again.
Look back at the stay chat room.
Matthew Ingram, pick something for me.
So I picked something out of the rundown that we didn't get to. It looks like Twitter has finally answered my prayers from about 6 years ago, maybe. And they're highlighting lists.
They're back, Twitter, baby. Twitter lists are back.
They're much more prominent in the redesign. So there's a menu and list is right in there.
Oh,
so
nice.
Instead of having to click six nested submenus to get to your lists, I use lists a lot. I don't know if other people do, but it's one of the only ways I can.
So where do I get? How do I get? So here's my Twitter page. And then
you may not have the.
I may not have it yet, but would it be over here on the left?
It'll be on the left.
Yeah. Yes, where lists used to be when they first created lists.
Yeah. So I've got home, explore, notifications, messages, bookmarks, lists, profile are all in a menu on the left instead of sort of up at the top.
Oh, I hope to get that. Yeah. I use lists all the time.
I remember, I think it was Ev Williams or somebody admitted that. They should have done way more with lists. Yeah. It was such an obvious
way of so great.
To curate their streams, and they've just ignored them forever. It was like the redheaded stepchild of
I use in TweetDeck, I make columns out of, so I have, for instance, here's a list of tech journalists, and so I just have the tech journalist list as one of the columns in TweetDeck, and that way I'm going to make sure I see all the tweets.
Yeah, a way of doing that without TweetDeck, basically.
Yeah. This is using a list. Yeah,
you can make them public.
Yep. Nice. Very nice.
So thank you, Twitter.
Good. Thank you, Twitter.
But get rid of the Nazis as well.
Jeff Jarvis, do you have a number or a pick or something?
Well,
you'd like
I was going to talk about how Google has bought up almost all the real estate between 15th and 16th Streets and 8th Avenue and the River to start our own little tech village. And how I actually think maybe they should put some apartments in there, and I would have.
Toronto.
I think he's saying he would happily live there.
Toronto
Google
has
is censoring.
Yes, I would.
Rogers has finally had it with Jeff.
But I'm not going to do that because it's an old joke now. So I just want to. So Benjamin Dreyer, I mentioned before, he's great on Twitter too. Today he has a copy editing pro tip. If you spit on the president's son today, tomorrow you can say that you spit on him or that you spat on him. Either is correct.
So past tense of spit is spit or spat.
He would say spat. You saw that story, by the way, yes?
What if you spit on him in a spat?
If I'm having a spat with him and I spit on him, did I spit during the spat or spat during the spat?
I don't know.
I spat during the spat.
Alternate usage is spoot.
I did not see that story, but I am not going to fall for your leftist plan.
That's right.
So there, I presume that you will be glued to the television later this evening when the 3,000 candidates for president on the Democratic Party will be on stage, each trying to get one word in edgewise. It'll be much like this show was.
5 hours. 5 hours.
No, I don't.
This was not 5 hours, was it? No.
No.
I'm not hungry yet.
No, the debates are going to be fun.
Aren't they constrained? Wow, I mean, aren't they like over when they can't have just keep going like this show can?
Sure they can. Sure
they can?
No, they have a moderator. That's what the moderator's for.
Hurry
up.
Dream job.
I'll be the moderator.
Technology will be the topic. Any bets on how many candidates will demand the breakup of Google?
Well, we know Warren.
Well, Elizabeth Warren on tonight, she will,
But don't you think that will then make Warren. Everybody else do that? We got to keep up with the Warrens?
Probably.
No, because a lot of their funding is going to come from these companies.
Oh.
Because they are, after all Democrats.
Oh, yes, all of them. Man, I can't wait for people like, you know, the Uline people. The problem is right now, tech is such a... you know what? Let's end the show. We're good.
Yeah.
I'm not going.
You
not
just said a bunch of words. I don't know what the hell they mean, but I'm going to assume that they were cogent and say thank you for your contribution, Stacy Thistlebottom.
Hip, hip, cheerio.
Hello, Stacy. Jolly good. Stacy on IoT.com is her website. That's where you can sign up for a free newsletter on the Internet of Things. You should also listen to her IoT podcast with Kevin Toefel every week. And if I have not offended her to the marrow, she will be back next week on This Week in Google. Maybe. Could be. Perhaps. Perchance.
I'm not easily offended.
Thank you, Stacy. Thank you for being here and putting up with us old white men. Chief of WHOOM is, of course, the great Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at CUNY.
The whitest, oldest white man around. Yeah.
I think, though, I think we're of an age, so I don't know if you can actually say you're the whitest, oldest man here.
But you know, my Chromebook camera sure beats the heck out of that independent camera. I actually look like I'm human.
This one looks good. It's doing well. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Jeff.
Maybe you're just meant to be seen via Chromebook, Jeff.
Could be. Will you be appearing on MSNBC or as a TV guide, former TV guide critic anytime soon?
Nothing scheduled.
Nothing planned? Okay. Want to give you a chance to plug that. And ladies and gentlemen, of course, the great Matthew Ingram. He is in charge of digital writing and soon to win the fabulous
James W. Carey Award.
James W. Carey Award. I shouldn't forget that name. I used to work with a guy named James Carey. He was James Carey. He was one of the Carey brothers. They were home improvement specialists. But that's not the same one, I don't think. The James W. Carey Award for Media Ethics or something. Thank you.
That's the official name or something.
Thank you. Chief digital writer at CJR.org. I'm just jealous, Matthew. I'm just jealous. That's all it is. I'm just jealous. Thank you all for joining us. We do This Week in Google, the car wreck that it is every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. I love it. It's the messiest show we do, and I love it. 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch or listen live, you can do that at twit.tv/live. The chat room awaits if you're doing it live at irc.twit.tv. A bunch of great people congratulating Matthew right now on his major award. We also invite you to get on-demand versions at our website, twit.tv/twig. Or, as I mentioned earlier, we really appreciate you supporting us by subscribing. That way you'll get it automatically every single week the minute it's available. And then you don't have to worry. You just say, hey, it's Thursday morning. What can I listen to? Oh, yeah, Twig. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.